Tonight, the bombing of cities in World War II. This is the anniversary. 74 years ago, Dresden, one of the most beautiful cultured cities in Europe, was destroyed. Never was a city destroyed so thoroughly and completely in such a short space of time as Dresden. And the 13th to the 15th of February 1945 was when that happened. And so it's a good time to use this as a memorial milestone in order to remember the lessons we can take from this. It's part of the Reformation Society. It's also an important part of the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, bombing of cities in Second World War. Theodore Roosevelt said, to anger a conservative, lie to him. To anger a liberal, tell him the truth. So I'm sure this presentation will anger liberals because a lot of it's the truth, but it also will present some of the lies told against these very issues that it's dealing with, which should anger us to realize we've been lied to. I remember watching films like Hanover Street, Memphis Belle, and others where they make the bombers heroes and completely dehumanize the men, women, children, families, pets, schools, hospitals, and everything else below that they were saturation bombing. I look back now and think, how could I have been cheering watching films like The Dam Busters? But I was as much a victim of the propaganda, and I had accepted so much of it too, thinking of these bombers as heroes, whereas we shouldn't actually think of bombing civilians as heroic. Political correctness is intellectual dishonesty. Just take some of the words we've used. Saturation bombing. Strategic bombing. Collateral damage. Those are politically correct terms which are intellectually dishonest. Now, I have been bombarded on missionary outreaches in Sudan. I've experienced aerial, artillery, and rocket bombardments. I took this picture under fire in Sudan, and in fact, I would have had some great war correspondence photographs, except for my military training, because I had the old 35mm, 36-spool film in my camera, and as this, I had my camera in my belt, had a belt pouch for camera, and as the bombing started, I'd just come out from under the, you see they didn't have doors, but a very thatched roof, very thick, it deadened the sound of people screaming or running because someone had shouted Antonovs, and I was the last to leave the church because Antonov flying overhead doesn't mean you're the target. I've had so many false alarms, so I was awfully slow after you. I was the last to get out, and as I ducked over double to bend to get under the roof, I heard the high-pitched screams of the bombs. And I knew it was so loud, so close, such a crescendo, there was no time to look, to see, to take another step, to try and get to the trench. I just lay flat. And as I did, the ground shook. 5 1,000-kilogram bombs landed in succession. And I whipped out my camera, lying in a position. I took some pictures while the debris was still in the air and the flames. I could see the pillar fire. And it was extraordinary. At that moment, I was thinking what my mother told me. In a bombing, keep your mouth open. And try if you can to cover your ears, but you've got to keep your mouth open. Don't clench your teeth. You will burst your eardrums. You must keep your mouth open. I mean, your most natural thing is to tense. That's the wrong thing to do. You've got to cover your ears, open your mouth, or your eardrums will burst. You've got to equalize the pressure. And I thought about that moment. First thought what my mother said, then I remember my father saying that as he saw the Heinkel bombers coming over his parade ground, he tilted his helmet to cover his neck because what goes up comes down. And I remember that. But as I took out, and I took some pictures of the pillars of fire and of the debris flying and so on, and everything is coming down, and I think, boy, these are great pictures. And I got to the end, and as you reach the old cameras, 36, and sometimes go to 37, it starts to automatically rewind. And I went into military mode. I opened the camera to pull out the spool, and I exposed just about all the pictures I'd just taken as I was ready. And this is the only picture of the whole lot, of that whole row that got saved, because when I realized what I was doing, I slammed it shut. I'd exposed. This was automatically rewinding. And I was so into, you know, magazine out, insert next magazine, and I exposed all my action pictures. Not intelligent. we've seen a lot of churches bombed and burned. I've preached about 1,200 times in Sudan, lectures and sermons, chaplain services. And I've never spoken a school, a church, a building that hasn't been bombed at least once. One church had been bombed 18 times. This church had been bombed 10 times, destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time. Birthplace of Christianity in southern Sudan, Luy Cathedral. This bomb did not explode. This is another time, another place. But if it had exploded, if this 1,000-kilogram bomb had exploded, it would have taken the compound, the church we were meeting, off the map. But for some reason, the SPLA dug it out. I said, why would you dig out an unexploded bomb? They said, we need the explosives to give back to the Arabs. And some pastor quote in the background, it's more blessed to give than to receive. Well, I have recorded a whole lot of this in my Faith Under Fire in Sudan book. And, of course, we've taken in filmmakers like Pat Matriciana and the SATV war correspondent who was sent to do a hatchet job in Peter Hammond. And he ended up doing a very positive 3 days in Sudan film because he was bombed on day two with us in a church service. Now, these experiences were completely insignificant compared to that of my parents in the Second World War. My father served as a bombardier in the Royal Artillery in the British Army for the whole 6 years of the war, mostly in North Africa, also in Italy. He told me of the Heinkel 3s coming over his bomber base, his barracks, his Royal Artillery base, turning his barracks into matchsticks as he lay on the parade ground, tilting his helmet to cover his neck as the debris blew high into the air and came pummeling down on him. And I was thinking exactly of what my father told me decades before as I was lying there feeling bits of tree branch and rocks and some coming. That is my father. Indeed. As a young bombardier and in North Africa in the 8th Army with the Desert Rats. And my dad in Alexandria. And I don't know if you can see very clearly, but it actually says Gone with the Wind behind this. Gone with the Wind was showing at the cinema in Alexandria at the time. And he had borrowed a New Zealander's motorbike on that occasion to see the film. Probably AWOL. And when I think of what my father had to say, that was still insignificant compared to what my mother went through. My mother, Ingrid Lindemann, was only 6 years old when she experienced her first bombing. It was September 1940 when she is at the circus in Berlin when the British bombed them. She has almost trampled in a stampede to flee the exploding bombs. Many times, in fact, my mother said over 62 times she endured aerial bombardments from a 6-year-old to an 11-year-old. She heard the air raid sirens, had to rush to air raid shelters, and she frequently saw the green and red parachute flares, she called them the Christmas trees, dropped by the lead bombers to guide the 1,000 bombers where to unload their cargo of death and destruction. The British came by night, the Americans came by day. Berlin was subjugated to the greatest aerial bombardment any city in the history of the world has. Her neighborhood was turned into blazing rubble, and she was evacuated at a certain point and went to Minden, where she endured other bombings and later so-called liberation by the Canadians who destroyed their home, stole everything they had, and all the rest. So that's the background to why I'm dealing with the bombing of cities in World War II. I want to know why my mother was bombed and what was the strategy behind that. U.S. Air Force General James Doolittle protested that the attacks on civilian centers, which he had been commanded to undertake, would be terrorism without any justification on military grounds. Now, just think about those words for a moment. We know that a man who puts a bomb in a civilian area is a terrorist. Car bomb, like Church Street, which we had in 1983, or a limpet mine in a suitcase, or the bomb, the petrol bomb in a suitcase in Johannesburg Central Station, which incinerated that grandmother and her granddaughter, which was one of the bombings that Nelson Mandela was convicted for and pleaded guilty to, by the way. And we know that car bombs, suicide bombers, limpet mines, these things are terrorism. But what do you call a man who flies 20,000 feet over a suburb and drops 14 tons of bombs and high explosives on that suburb? Is that not terrorism? U.S. Air Force General Ben Parton, a good friend, his home was the first home I stayed in America when I first went to America in 1988. I've stayed in his home more than any other home in America. There's no American I spent more time with on more meetings and who organized more meetings for me than General Ben Parton. He's a member of our board too. General Ben Parton told me it was while studying in the 1940s, the strategic saturation bombing campaigns of World War II that led him as a Christian to pioneer and promote precision-guided weapons to save civilian lives in future conflicts. He was horrified. Amongst the many things, I've traveled many tens of thousands of kilometers with this man, discussing all sorts of things, spent hours into the night, past midnight, discussing with him, traveled with him on the Potomac River, been to the Pentagon with him, been to Congress and all these different places, and learned a lot from this man who was too young to serve in the Air Force in the Second World War. Well, he'd started his training during the war, but the war had ended, and his war was career in Vietnam as a pilot. He flew the B-52s and all that sort of thing. But he is primarily a scientist and engineer. And so he designed laser. He gave the name to laser. In fact, I've never heard anyone else explain what laser stands for. He told me, General Parton told me, light amplified stimulation emission radiation, laser. He designed laser back in the 1950s, precision guided weapons, based on what he gleaned from Professor Werner von Braun and others from Peenemünde and the vast shiploads of patents that had been looted from Germany and from Peenemünde that the Americans were able to base their whole space rocket program on. But Germany started, in fact, the first precision guided weapon was the Fritz. It was a wire-guided bomb that was used to sink a battleship, in fact. So all of these are, in fact, on display at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, which I've taken my family to just outside Washington, D.C., very interesting, by Dulles International Airport. And, of course, as General Parton described to us, the Germans were 10 to 15 years ahead of all of us. And when we got all these patents and all these insights, and we got 2,000 German scientists shipped over to America, including Werner von Braun, he said it put us right at the head of the pack in all this technology. Rockets, jets, aircraft carriers, the whole thing, for jet launching, the whole lot. So he said, as he studied it, he saw that the U.S. Air Force bombing of Germany was the equivalent in conventional bombing and destruction and loss of life to 50 atom bombs of the Hiroshima type. Many people think, oh, well, at least Germany was spared Hiroshima type atom bomb. No, they weren't. They got 50 times the destruction and killing power of the Hiroshima bombings, but by conventional 1,000-bomber raids. No country has ever been subjected to the kind of bombing that Germany was, or division at that matter. So General Parton said that as a Christian, he was sickened by the whole understanding of saturation bombing and strategic bombing, and determined that it had to be a Christian solution, that if you want to take out a bridge, you take out the bridge without destroying the city around it. You've got to use precision guided weapons. And so he is the one who pioneered everything from cluster bombs to cruise missiles, GPSs to deliver them, and all that, button batteries. All of these were things that General Ben Parton pioneered. Eminent British war historian Captain Sir Basil Littlehart, and I remember reading him as a young teenager in Rhodesia. He is one of the most fascinating war historians that introduced me to tank warfare and all the rest of it. He described the strategic bombing campaign by Royal Air Force Bomber Command during the Second World War as the most uncivilized means of warfare that the world had known since the Mongol invasions. Bear in mind that the Mongols killed 12% of the total population of the world in the 13th century. The Mongol invasions was the greatest destruction and the most savage warfare the world has ever known, even worse than what the Assyrians did, which was the worst up to that stage. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain declared that England's policy of bombing cities in Germany was absolutely contrary to international law. Now, he's referring to the Washington Treaty of 1922, the Hague Convention of 1898 and 1907, the Geneva Conventions and all the rest. Absolutely contrary to international law. Just before being ousted in Winston Churchill's palace coup, Prime Minister Chamberlain announced His Majesty's government will never resort to the deliberate attack on women and children and other civilians for the purpose of mere terrorism. And that's the terms they used. Bombing civilians is terrorism, and that's its only purpose. Shortly after replacing Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister, Winston Churchill declared our supreme effort must be to gain overwhelming mastery in the air. The bombers alone can provide the means to victory. So that was the whole thought, bombers for victory. Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Lord Trenchard, as early as 1921, just 2 years after the First World War, declared the next war could be won by bombing alone, by destroying the enemy's will to resist. What's destroying the enemy's will to resist? It's another word for terrorism, basically. You use terrorism to destroy his will to resist. Now, the 20th century began with a campaign in South Africa to destroy the enemy's will to resist. It was called Scorched Earth and the concentration camp policies. Unable to defeat the Boers in the field, the British Empire began the 20th century with Scorched Earth and concentration camp policies, destroying all 30,000 farms in the Transvaal and the Free State, poisoning all those wells, burning those houses, dynamiting the wells, dynamiting the homes, and putting the women and children to unhygienic concentration camps where they died at a greater rate than any death rate in any concentration camp in the Second World War. 250 out of every 1,000 died every year. So in the British concentration camps, in 2 years, half of the inmates had died. In 4 years, there would be no one left alive statistically, if the present trends had continued when Emily Hobhouse documented it. So they had decided to, of course, they didn't have aircraft in 1900 to 1902 in the Anglo-Boer War, but they used Scorched Earth. Now they're going to destroy the enemy's will to resist from the air. This was the policy already as early as 1921. From this perspective, an entire strategic philosophy developed, which was later to dominate British and later American military strategy. No countries in the history of the world put more money into bombing campaigns and bombers and strategic bombing than Britain and America. The British and the United States led the field. There has never been air force in the world to compare with the bombing capabilities of the RAF and the US Army Air Force. It was Italian general, though, Giulio Dohet, who had predicted that in the next war, bombers could inflict millions of civilian casualties in a matter of days. Totally impossible, actually, by the technology available at the time, but that was what many people believed. And this is one of his pioneer books that so inspired many people in Britain and America to adopt this policy and put most of their military funding into it. Stanley Baldwin, Prime Minister of Britain, described this new military philosophy in the House of Commons, not agreeing with it, condemning it. The only defense is offense, which means that you have to kill more women and children more quickly than the enemy if you want to save yourselves. And he wasn't saying this to advocate, he was saying this to condemn it, that this is an unacceptable philosophy. Although aircraft were only invented in 1903 and first used militarily, at least in any large scale, in the First World War of 1914 to 1918, books and films had developed a public dread of aerial bombing out of all proportion to the actual threat. This is actually interesting, just where you see the First World War, you've got the air, you've got the trenches, you've got the barbed wire, artillery. This kind of epitomizes the First World War in many ways. But of course, you can also add submarines, tanks, gas, flamethrowers. Inspired more by science fiction novels of H.G. Wells and Alexander Korda's film Things to Come, the Royal Air Force experts declared, as an article of faith, the bomber will always get through. Which isn't actually true, but they believed it. Strangely, these men failed to anticipate that technical developments in one area of warfare are soon matched by countermeasures in other areas. Aircraft advanced rapidly in the First World War. Just as gas warfare was soon countered by gas masks, anti-aircraft technology soon caught up with the aerial threat. Night bombers were later countered by night fighters and radar. Yet many British politicians and military leaders leapt upon the philosophy of faint hearts. After the disastrous battles of the First World War, and they were catastrophic, I mean, the British lost 85% of the army in the first 4 months of the war. Before Christmas 1914, 85% of the British army was either dead or injured to the extent they couldn't continue. They had to raise an entirely new army because the entire British army had been wiped out in the trenches of Belgium and France. 85% casualty rate in the first 4 months of the First World War. It was catastrophic. They lost 650,000 men in a four-month battle of the Somme in 1916. That's more British died in 4 months gaining 4 miles, which are later lost, in Belgium and France in the Battle of Somme. Then they lost on all fronts in 6 years of the Second World War. The catastrophic losses in the First World War, just to depict it in this way, most Hammonds who died in action died in 10 miles of Ypres. I've seen the names of 84 Hammonds on the walls of 6 war cemeteries in Ypres, and the names on the walls are the ones they couldn't have find the body for, so there's no grave for them, because if there's a grave, the name would be on the cross or the tombstone. The names on the walls are the people they couldn't find the bodies for, because of the artillery. Artillery killed more than 60% of people in the First World War. So when I went to British War and Commonwealth War Graves Commission, they went in their computer and said, oh, there were 480 Hammonds who were killed in action in the First World War on the British side. 480, just of our family name. In the Battle of Passchendaele, most of the British and Canadian losses were friendly fire, their own artillery, or they drowned in the mud that their artillery had created in preparing the way for the army, and they literally, everything disappeared. Cavalry, horses, armor, artillery, wagons, guns, people disappeared. They still dig them out of the ground in Passchendaele. Passchendaele was one of the worst disasters. Sorry? Because Belgium and Holland is mostly low water table, and therefore it doesn't take much if you break the drainage and you break the whole ground up, that in fact the water from below seeps up even more, and they put 5 tons of high explosive on every square meter of the front, and then they marched their troops into it. And so you can imagine, for 10 days, 5 million artillery shells in a limited space. Then they marched their troops in, and the Canadians and others just disappeared into mud. When the general was told to consolidate, he says, you cannot consolidate porridge. I can't even find my army. They've disappeared into the mud that the artillery has created. And then some of the Canadians advanced so fast that they were getting wiped out by the British artillery, who didn't anticipate that they'd advance so fast. The coordination wasn't right. So they lost more people to friendly fire. And that's not even talking about the other battles in Ypres. Passchendaele was just a little bit further. Ypres is the greatest disaster in the British Army's history. They lost more men in 10 miles of Ypres than in all other battles combined. The British feared to face the German soldier on the battlefield, and they sought for an indirect way of winning a war. Instead of facing hundreds of thousands of soldiers and losing hundreds of thousands of soldiers facing German army on the ground, they would now drop millions of tons of bombs on German cities from a safe height of 10,000 feet or more. This was the philosophy. British military strategists conclude that what had actually won the First World War was the British Royal Navy blockade, which had led to starvation conditions in Germany. The 4-year naval blockade. Germany might have won the battles on the ground, but Britain starved them into submission. The Royal Navy was the war-winning weapon. Starvation blockades, the naval blockades of World War I. These are the politics of hunger or blockade. Cruiser warfare and the starvation of Germany in World War I. So they make it quite clear their goal was the starvation of all civilians. Men, women, children, old, young. Churchill, First Lord Admiralty, said, our goal is to starve all Germans. Men, women, children, of course Austrians too. It became an article of faith amongst the chiefs of staff that the bombing of German cities would achieve victory in the war without the need to commit the armies to the kind of ground warfare that had caused so many casualties in the Western Front, 1914 to 1918. And in fact, bear in mind, in the Second World War, the British evacuated in a matter of weeks through Dunkirk. When they started to face the German blitzkrieg, they didn't want to stand and fight like they had in the First World War. They fled. And they evacuated. And then for the rest of the war, they were depending on the bomber to do the job. Underlying this philosophy was the assumption that German civilians would crack under the pressure of sustained bombing. But actually, despite enduring the most sustained aerial bombardments for over 5 years, they never did crack. There never was a breaking down of the will of the people to work in the factories, to fight in the front, or whatever else constitutes holding a nation together. In fact, war production in Germany steadily increased throughout the war. Now, the Spanish Civil War of 1936-1939 heavily affected people's thinking about the coming war. the war was between the nationalists and the so-called Republicans, but in fact, that's not accurate. The Republicans are well marked red because the Republicans were actually communists. This is where Ernest Hemingway and others were fighting on the Republican side, but actually it was as red as the Soviet Union and the Red Army. Franco, the nationalist leader who saved Spain from communist takeover, he was fighting a communist Bolshevik revolution of the sort that the Soviet Union was suffering under. So while they called them the Republicans, it was another word for communist, actually, in this case. So you had the nationalists who won under General Franco and the communists who lost. And the Soviet Union was supporting the Reds along with Britain and America. And it was Italy and Germany who were supporting the nationalists of General Franco. Now, the communists had their clenched fist. These are the so-called Republicans. They were as communist as they come. And, of course, they were glamorized, like the ANC and ZANU-PF and SWAPO have been glamorized by the leftist media in our times. When, during the Spanish Civil War, the nationalists bombed Barcelona in 1938, reportedly 1,300 inhabitants were killed. In fact, a gross exaggeration, but that's what was reported. And Barcelona was subject to bombing, and from this, the British aerial experts conclude that each ton of bombs dropped would inflict 72 casualties. Wildly inaccurate. In fact, the casualty rates at Barcelona were barely 3 casualties for every ton of bombs dropped, and a casualty doesn't mean dead. Casualty can mean wounded, from slightly to seriously to crippled to dead. So casualty is a very broad category. But the British extrapolate this somehow to 72 deaths for every ton of bombs dropped, whereas it was barely 3 casualties to every ton of bombs dropped. But this figure of 72 per ton was treated as definitive. And on this basis, the British Home Office predicted 1 million casualties in London in the first few days of the next war. They literally were expecting that kind of casualties from the war, and yet they pushed for the war. But this alarmist nonsense had no basis. In fact, of the 500,000 people killed in the entire 3 years of the Spanish Civil War, less than 3% were killed by air raids. Air raids were not the primary way of killing. Just like the hysteria about gas warfare in the First World War, gas warfare didn't even kill 2% of the people who died in the First World War, not even 1%. Most people died from artillery. Artillery killed 60% of the people who died in the First World War. But artillery doesn't seem to get the headlines. It was gas in the First World War, and it was air power in the Second. But these facts did not support Bomber Command's philosophy, so they were suppressed at the time. Don't let facts get in the way of a good story. Barcelona civilians hiding from bombardment in the underground tunnels for the trams where they had their transport. And, of course, many people's lives were displaced and ruined. But the fact that the German Luftwaffe had no four-engine bombers, nor did they have any plans to produce any four-engine bombers in the future. There weren't any even in the planning stage. This was suppressed. They also didn't have a landing craft designed. They didn't have one aircraft carrier, and they didn't have any aircraft designed that could land on or take off an aircraft carrier. But they were meant to be wanting world domination, apparently, despite the fact that they didn't even attempt to seize the French Navy, which had battleships and aircraft carriers and so on. How are you going to challenge the British, who had this colossal navy? The German navy was never even close to 20% the size of the British Royal Navy. And when you think of how the Royal Navy had 13 aircraft carriers and how many battleships, and the German navy had nothing even close to it. But nevertheless, the Royal Air Force had a colossal bomber command, and the German bomber command was a joke in comparison. It was so small. But you wouldn't get that impression watching the film Battle of Britain, because you only see German bombers. You never see a British bomber, and you never see a German casualty of the British bombardments of Germany, although they refer to it, but you don't show it. So Battle of Britain's a very well-made, highly inspiring piece of propaganda. The entire German Luftwaffe was plainly geared only to ground support of the Luftwaffe, like through these Stukas. Precision weapons to go just ahead of the Panzer and infantry and prepare or soften the resistance or weaken the resistance so that they can punch through and achieve their offensive goals. The Heinkel 111 had only a 1-ton carrying capacity. Now, British Lancaster had a 14-ton carrying capacity by comparison. and they were only designed for ground support of Panzer units. They both had very short ranges. They couldn't travel across the continent like the British Lancasters or the American Flying Fortresses. These were only very short range, not strategic, in other words. Basically, they were going just ahead of the infantry and Panzer advance on the ground. Plainly, Germany had no intention of strategic bombing of cities. It wasn't in their philosophy, it wasn't in their equipment. Germany's heaviest bomber did not even have the capacity to carry 10% of the payload of bombs that a British Lancaster was designed for. Not even 10%. Now, this is a German Heinkel. Actually, very small plane compared to this massive three-story block of flats type of Lancaster bomber, which could carry 14 tons of bombs. Now, here you can see a Heinkel. Look at the size of the people relative to the bomber. Now look at this Lancaster. This is the British bombers. And you can see this is absolutely colossally massive, three stories, effectively. And the size of the bombs, each bomb more than what the Heinkel could carry in total. Now, of course, bear in mind the distance, perspective, but look at the size of people. You get a bit of an idea. You put a Heinkel next to a Lancaster, it's like putting a DC-3 next to a jumbo jet. It just gets dwarfed. The earliest British air raids, though, on Germany were quite disappointing for Bomber Command. On the 4th of September 1939, just the day after Britain had declared war on Germany, an RAF attack on a German seaplane base resulted in 24 of the 28 British bombers being shot down. I mean, that's pretty embarrassingly disastrous. 24 of their planes lost out of 28, and the survivors managed to drop only a few bombs, and by mistake they dropped the bombs on the Danish town of Eisbjerg, which is 190 kilometers from the target. How disastrously, embarrassingly failure can anything be? I understand you'd be disoriented if people are actually shooting at you with anti-aircraft guns, but still, that was bad. Air raids on German warships in Wilhelmshaven were also ineffective. The British first targets were Navy, of course. The few bombs that actually hit their targets either did not explode or bounced off the German armor, causing no damage at all. The early casualties suffered by the British bombers were extreme. Two air raids on oil installations in a row by over 300 British bombers achieved no hits, no damage whatsoever to the plants. Photographic evidence of the RAF bombing raids on the industrial Ruhr, that's the real industrial heart, like our Witwatersrand, for example, revealed that less than 10% of the British bombers got within 5 miles of their target, and the bombs dropped by these aircraft were dispersed in areas 75 square miles around the intended target. Now, this is pretty bad. This is about as bad as it gets, because you're totally missing. You've got a target, and some of your bombs are landing 75 miles away. The area that these bombs were dropped by these aircraft were dispersed in areas 75 square miles around the intended target, killing probably more cows than anything else. During the air raids of 1940 and 1941, more British aircrew died than German victims of the bombings, military, civilian, all contold. So the first 2 years of Bomber Command, you would have thought, this is a disaster, this is a catastrophe, let's close it down. But they'd invested 80% of the military budget into this. They couldn't afford to give up, they thought. So the German battle cruisers Scharnhorst and Gneisenau at Brest were attacked by 1,723 sorties. Now, Brest is in France, just across the channel, super close, really easy, close range to the British. They flew 1,723 sorties against these without managing to actually damage these battle cruisers. Almost 2,000 tons of bombs were dropped on these ships, yet Scharnhorst and Gneisenau survived these air raids mostly unscathed. Bit of paintwork, not much serious problems. And these battle cruisers were a threat to the Royal Navy, they thought. The RAF Bomber Command received more funding, labor, strategic materials, and equipment than all other branches of the British military combined. When you are in the Battle of Britain film, which is such a rousing 1960s film, I mean, what great music and all that, and soaring sights of these Spitfires soaring, and, you know, continually talking about how few fighters they had. Well, why do they have so few fighters? Because they put everything into bombers, the Navy and bombers. So they had very few fighters, comparatively. And so why was Britain denuded of adequate fighter support? Because they're putting it all into offensive Bomber Command. But that doesn't even come out in the film. And this is what the British were busy building in Manchester and in Coventry, and the labor of thousands of workers and factories all over Britain, most of them owned by the Rothschilds. They were making bombs, lots of bombs, serious amounts of bombs, massive amounts of bombs, and they were loading them up into planes like this. Now notice each bomb painted on the side there indicates a successful bombing raid by this Lancaster. So this crew has bombed a lot of cities in Germany. And these people posing like this, doubtless they thought that this was something positive. But Kiel is a port city like Cape Town. Why would you pose for a terror bombing of a bomb being dropped on civilians unless you'd been so propagandized that you didn't think of those as people that you're dropping the bombs on? I mean, what would you think of somebody who dropped bombs on Cape Town or car bomb or whatever? People put a bomb in Plant Hollywood or threw those grenades into St. James Church. But here we're talking about 14 tons being dropped by this crew on people in Kiel, and they thought this was worthy of a picture, and they felt proud of it. You can only do that if you're so blinded by propaganda, you don't understand what you're doing. And so most of these bombs, though, from all over Britain, were being scattered across Germany to no good purpose. Raw materials that could have been better used to build tanks and ground support aircraft and fighters and dive bombers and machine guns and rifles and medical supplies were being squandered to fulfill an obsession with bomber as the war-winning weapon to beat all weapons. And again, you can see these women with, I don't know if they always had their hair blow-dried like this, like that comes straight out of the hairdresser, but maybe it was specifically because it was a propaganda photo shoot that day. But still, all these women putting all this work into this, but what are they putting the work into? This is akin to, in my mind, a Muslim mother dressing up her son with a suicide bombing vest to go out and kill people. This is a terrorist weapon. This is not something used to defend your country. This is something used to bomb civilian cities. Yet far from winning the war, the bomber almost lost the war by absorbing the resources that could have been used to equip Britain with genuine weapons of war for military targets. Instead of recognizing the strategic bombing campaign was a failure, the chiefs of staff determined to concentrate the bombing on cities. Okay, we can't hit a factory. We can't hit a battleship, but you can't miss with a city. If the city's big enough, you unload your bombs in the middle, you're going to hit something. And so a policy of terrorizing the German population became a fundamental component of the strategic bombing campaign of the Royal Air Force. Recognizing that navigational aids were deficient and that bomb sites used were highly inaccurate, Bomber Command determined to concentrate entire air wings into 1,000 bomber raids. This had never been done in the history of the world before. 1,000 bomber raids moving in a block. So that they're like a phalanx. The whole idea was like Alexander the Great's phalanx, where the troops would march with their spears and you couldn't get to them. They're like porcupines. And every one of these bombers has got moving machine gun nests and door gunners and top gunners and rear gunners and front gunners and underneath gunners. And so all together, no fighter aircraft can get close to us. We're moving like a phalanx together, unbeatable block of 1,000 bombers. And a fighter comes and he's suddenly going to have thousands of 50 caliber machine guns aimed at him. How many fighters are going to have the courage to come close? They thought. These nighttime saturation bombings wouldn't be able to miss their targets because they'd concentrate in the center of a large city. Killing Germans, any Germans, became the policy of Bomber Command. They start off with, we're going to get their navy, we're going to get their bases, we're going to get their ball bearing factories. And once they realized we're not even getting close to the target, they said, well, okay, let's just bomb the city. Here's a historic picture of dead from a bombing campaign being laid out to be prepared for decent burial. You can see the coffins in the background there. It's just disgusting. These are civilians, women mostly, in dresses. Between 1940 and 1945, 61 German cities were destroyed in bombing campaigns by RAF Bomber Command. At least 2 million German civilians were killed by the air raids of the Royal Air Force and the United States Army Air Force. This is before America had an air force, it was called the United States Army Air Force, USAAF. Later it became USAF, but So this isn't a typographical error. It's just recognizing this is before the American Air Force was launched. It was still Army Air Force. I get this statistic from General Ben Parton, who did his master's study on this in the Air War College, studying how effective the saturation bombing was. Indiscriminate bombing was internationally outlawed by the Washington Treaty of 1922, which expressly forbade the use of bombing civilian populations. United States propaganda films, like Why We Fight, condemned the Japanese Empire for bombing cities such as Shanghai. Now, this picture's been proven since to actually be photoshopped. This burning baby sitting in the middle of Shanghai. That picture was from another scene, but they photoshopped in the baby here with the destruction behind to give a feel of what the Japanese bombing of Shanghai was. And if you watch the American films like Why We Fight, these demonic, evil, barbaric savages of Japan bomb cities. Of course, what the propagandists didn't realize is that was the policy of their own government once they went to war just a few months later. But it's there. I've got the film. They condemn the Japanese for they are savages because they bomb cities. Not as effectively as America did later. Upon America's entry into the war, General H.H. Arnold advocated the policy of strategic bombing of cities as the only way Germany could be beaten. Winston Churchill commented, "The air opened paths along which death and terror could be carried far behind the lines of the actual enemy to women, children, the aged, the sick, who in earlier struggles would perforce have been left untouched." Air Force historian Dennis Richards, in the official history of the Royal Air Force, 1939-1945, wrote, "If the Royal Air Force raided the Ruhr, destroying oil plants with its most accurately placed bombs and urban property for those went astray, the outcry for retaliation against Britain might prove too strong for the German generals to resist." Indeed, Hitler himself would probably lead the clamor. The attack on the Ruhr was therefore an informal invitation to Luftwaffe to bomb London. You see, both sides were restrained. For example, at no time during the war did any side use gas warfare, which had been used in abundance in the First World War. But the idea was, if one does it, the other's going to do it in retaliation. So they held off on gas warfare. But bombing of cities was something Britain started, and they wanted London bombed. The principal secretary of the Air Ministry in Britain reported, "We began to bomb objectives on the German mainland before the Germans began to bomb objectives on the British mainland. Because we were doubtful about the psychological effect of the truth, that it was we who started the strategic bombing offensive, we have shrunk from giving our great decision of May 11, 1940, the publicity it deserves." Now, this is written by J.M. Sprat, the principal secretary to the Air Ministry. Now, remember, in Britain, the secretary of the Air Ministry, a secretary, he basically runs it. He's like the manager or director. So where you see secretary, it may not hold the same force in your mind here, but to the British, the principal secretary of the Air Ministry, he's the man who actually carried out the will of the minister of the air. So he is basically the director and the manager. Notice May 11. May 11, 1940 is the day Winston Churchill became Prime Minister of Britain. The day after the war on the Western Front began. And Neville Chamberlain was ousted and Churchill came in an internal coup without election. See, the democracies were being run by people who weren't elected. Smuts wasn't elected to be head of South Africa. He had done a coup against our highly popular Prime Minister, James Barry Hertzog, in 1939, who'd won five elections in a row. And finally, when he refused to declare war on Germany, Smuts did a coup and kicked out our elected Prime Minister here. Well, Neville Chamberlain was elected Prime Minister in Britain. He got ousted by Churchill's palace coup. And so there you've got two unelected men, Smuts and Churchill, both of whom had lost innumerable elections, running their countries in name of democracy. And of course, Stalin wasn't elected either. So very interesting how that's suddenly called democracies. But bombing vindicated. This is a man who thought bombing was great, and he calls it a great decision. Very appropriate to have a little bit of Air Force sounds in the background to remind us. I remember hearing when I used to hear these, when I was in the South African Army, it would always give a surge of pride and confidence because these were our guys. We were at the border and the terrorists didn't have those. Towards the end of the war, when we heard those sounds, fear would come into hearts because the Russians and Cubans had more and better and faster jets than we did. And it wasn't always the good guys' jets that we were hearing. But when I got to Sudan, every time we heard a jet, serious fear would rise in your heart because you knew only the enemy's got those and you're the target. So it's one thing to be on the giving side. It's another thing to be on the recipient side of these bombers. Now you can see from the British, and they're showing the distance they've got to travel to reach these targets in Germany and the goals. The bombers had phenomenal range, whereas the German bombers could never get anything close to the beginning of that. The American-British bombers were designed to go thousands of kilometers without refueling. The Allied air offensive against Germany, and you can see right from the beginning, though, this is just up to January the 1st, 1941, look at the amount of tons of bombs they've dropped on these different centers, and they're feeling awfully happy and proud about. This is a British publication. And you could just see the vast amount dropping the bombs on Kiel and on, yeah, Flossenbürg and Lübeck and Hamburg, all targets. Okay, so 1939, you can see the blue indicates British bombs. Of course, they're pretty bad. Blue looks like a benign color. But this is just 7th of September, which is the first week of the war. 1941... You can see the bombing done, mostly the bombing France, Belgium, Holland, but they're getting into Germany. Of course, the further in, the harder it is, because Germany's army had a lot of capability at that stage, anti-aircraft. Now, notice the red. The red is, because this is now 1944, the red are American Air Force bombing, so American Army Air Force. So the blue is British bombing, the red is American bombing. You can see, in fact, the Americans are doing a lot of bombing. By that stage. And by 1944 in August, you can see huge amounts of bombing. This is colossal. Going as far as Romania, why are they bombing Romania? Germany's petroleum came from Romania. Plosky oil fields. 1945, I mean, the war's virtually over, 6th of May. Doesn't matter. The red are the Americans, the blue are the British, and they're just blottering whole cities. There wasn't really a town or city in Germany that wasn't war damaged, if not destroyed. Now, to understand, 1942, German army was liberating vast amounts of Russia with many Ukrainians and Russians joining their side. Bear in mind that Finland, which is a democracy, was in support of Germany. So was Romania. So was Bulgaria. So was Hungary. They were allies. And they were democracies, but and of course the allies had dictatorships like the Soviet Union. But never mind. The Westward democracies and Central Powers were all bad people, and that's all that you need to know according to Hollywood. But it was more complex than that, because these countries in Eastern Europe had suffered at the hands of the communists and had suffered because of the Versailles Treaty, and they had a lot of grievances to resolve. So when Germany started the Operation Barbarossa to take down the Soviet Union, liberate Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and all these countries, they got volunteers from all over Europe. More than 500,000 non-German volunteers came to join in the war against Russia. They came from Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, even neutral countries. They came from Norway. Lots came from Belgium. Many Frenchmen joined the German army, French contingents, to fight in the East. And of course, Romania, Italy, Bulgaria contributed a lot. There were even some South Africans, a few Americans, and 6 British volunteers involved in Operation Barbarossa against the Soviet Union. It was a colossal operation over thousands of kilometers. But it's just more complex than what people would like to say. But when you hear, I was brought up with stories of how the British won the war. Well, the British didn't even inflict 4% of Germany's military casualties. The Americans didn't inflict more than 9% of Germany's military casualties. 85% of the German military who died in the Second World War, died in the Eastern Front. The Second World War was mainly a battle between the Soviet Union and Germany. It was mainly a battle between communism and nationalism. And the Western Front was actually a sideshow compared to the real center of gravity where most of the fighting, where most of the machinery, most of the dying and killing took place, which was in the Eastern Front. So here you can see people are fighting against communism, and they're being attacked at the back by fellow Christians who you would have thought could also be anti-communist. If I can put it this way, when we were on the border fighting against the Russians, Cubans, East Germans, and communist MPLA in Angola, there were students in Cape Town throwing petrol bombs and rocks, and there are people blocking roads and fouling up the situation here and causing demonstrations and riots and problems to undermine our economy. So we were fighting the communists who were threatening our lives on the border. And there were people who thought they were doing a good job by undermining our work, but they were actually serving the cause of the communists. And that's a small analogy to what people over there. There's people I know and highly respect who fought in the German army, people like Professor Fritz Haus, my professor of Old Testament at Baptist Theological College. And I asked Professor Haus, why were you fighting? Because, you know, here's an honorable, God-fearing man, one of the best Bible teachers I've ever come across. And he fought in the Eastern Front, and he fought in North Africa, and he's in Africa Corps, and he had a Bible study every night of the war, and even Erwin Rommel was attending his Bible study. So, Professor Haus, why were you fighting? He said, we were fighting against communism. And if someone asked me, what was I fighting for on the border? Well, other people say, you were in the apartheid army, you were fighting for racism. No, but if you asked me or anyone I was fighting with, we were fighting against communism. We were fighting against terrorism. That's what we were fighting. That, in our mind, was crystal clear. We were fighting communism and terrorism. So when I've spoken to German veterans like Professor Fritz Haus, I heard them say, we were fighting communism. It resonated with me because I understand. Now, we've been demonized and lied about in the media and Hollywood and our press and government and school textbooks right now, just like the Germans were. But just to understand how they saw themselves fighting against communism and terrorism. In an interview with the New York Times, the 10th of January, 1946, Air Marshal Tedder declared Germany lost the war because she had not followed the principle of total warfare. Do you understand that Britain already in September 1939 mobilized totally, 100%, factory 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, women mobilized by the millions into the agriculture, into the factories to release millions of men into the military in one way or another. And so did America, and so did Russia. In fact, all the Allied countries practiced total war from the beginning. In fact, America was totally mobilizing the women to the factories long before they got involved in the war, because they were providing the arsenal for democracy, most of which went to the Soviet Union to help totalitarianism, right from the beginning. So long before America got into the war with Pearl Harbor, America was mobilizing for total war, 24 hours a day, factory production 7 days a week, and women mobilized into it, and conscription, all the rest. Germany never, ever went to mobilizing women's factories. In fact, the Minister of Munitions was pleading with Adolf Hitler, please let the mothers be mobilized into factories. And he said, never. He said, there's 12 million men I could mobilize into your army if you would allow me to mobilize 12 million women into the factories. And he said, that's what we did wrong in the First World War. We're not going to do it again. And he would not let the women, the mothers, be mobilized into the factories, which Britain and Russia and America were doing. So Germany never practiced total war. In fact, they only went to 24 hours a day factory operations in 1943, by which time it was too late. Germany was literally stopping for Sundays, stopping in the evening, not having a 24-hour shift. They didn't go for total war. Germany, in fact, was breaking the rule of total warfare, according to Air Marshal Tedder. Now, you would have thought Germany was in total war and Britain was the one who's trying to play cricket and so on, but in fact, it was the other way around. Dennis Richards in the Royal Air Force, 1939-1945, the fight at odds, observed, retaliation was certain if we carried the war into Germany. Talking about bombing Germany. There was a reasonable possibility that our capital, London, and industrial centers like Manchester and Coventry would not have been attacked if we'd continued to refrain from attacking those of Germany. I mean, tit for tat. You attack my cities, I'll attack yours. The primary purpose of these raids, now this remembers being given by Dennis Richards, writing the Royal Air Force history. The primary purpose of these raids, which raids? The Royal Air Force raids, was to goad the Germans into undertaking reprisal raids of a similar character on on Britain. Such raids would arouse intense indignation in Britain against Germany and so create a war psychosis, without which it would be impossible to carry on a modern war. You need a war psychosis. So you've got to convince your people, we're fighting to defend our country. I mean, my father said he wasn't a British army. He was fighting because he thought Britain was under threat. Britain was under attack. And he was fighting to defend Britain, the British Empire, which was in danger of being destroyed. And we could lose Rhodesia, South Africa, everything if we didn't fight. He didn't realize that Germany made 16 different peace offers before the Battle of Britain even began. They didn't want to fight Britain. In fact, as has been put in Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, he said, Britain chose as her enemy the most pro-British people on the planet. I mean, nobody is more pro-Anglophile than Adolf Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and Hess and the whole bunch of the upper Third Reich hierarchy. They were such Anglophiles. They were totally pro-British. And they didn't want to fight Britain because of their racial views, and they saw the British are the same people, and they were even offering to help the British anywhere that they might need help, because they wanted the British Empire to continue. And that's why Adolf Hitler went against the advice of all of his generals when they were beating the British army. The British army was retreating, and he orders the panzers to stop and let them evacuate from Dunkirk. The entire British army was at their mercy. And they let them go because he said they've got an empire to care for. We mustn't interfere with their ability. And the general is saying, this is insane. They're going to come back and they're going to cause us lots of grief. The generals are seeing it as a war point of view, but Hitler was motivated by an ideology and a racial view, and he saw the British as our friends, not as our enemies. Because he didn't understand how much damage they'd do to his cities, but at that time. But this is the way of thinking. Pat Buchanan says, Britain chose as the enemy someone who loved the British Empire and wanted to continue, and chose the ally, America and FDR, who hated the British Empire and wanted to destroy it. And the price of winning the war was the destruction of the British Empire. And my dad said, if we had known that Britain was going to betray us, in fact, had already agreed to betray us as the price for American support, we wouldn't have been fighting over there. We were fighting because we thought our lives were at risk. But of course, that was lies and propaganda. British jurist F.J.P. Beale, in Advance to Barbarism, observed, it is one of the greatest triumphs of modern emotional engineering. That's another word for propaganda. Modern emotional engineering. That in spite of the plain facts of the case, which could never be disguised or even materially distorted, the British public throughout the Blitz period remained convinced that the entire responsibility for the sufferings it was undergoing rested on the German leaders. Too high praise cannot therefore be lavished upon the British emotional engineers, he means the propaganda people, for the infinite skill with which the public mind was conditioned prior to and during a period of unparalleled strain. The inhabitants of Coventry, for example, continued to imagine that their sufferings was due to the innate villainy of Adolf Hitler without a suspicion that a decision, splendid or otherwise, of the British war cabinet was a decisive factor in this case. Coventry was also the site of most of the Rothschilds munitions factories that were making the bombs that were being dropped in Germany. I mean, Coventry, in my mind, was some nice place where everyone minded their own business. I didn't realize it was a major center of British munitions production, including the weapons that were being dropped in Germany. So Archibald Sinclair, Secretary for Air, declared, I am in full agreement of terror bombing. I'm all for the bombing of working class areas in German cities. Terror bombing, that's their own words. On the 5th of July 1941, the city of Munster in Germany was bombed by 63 British Wellington bombers just after midnight. The city was unprepared without any anti-aircraft protection because they never expected. Why would you bomb a city like Munster? And you can see the Americans just cheering about this as a wonderful, great fires left Munster by raid. By the end of the war, 90% of the old city of Munster was destroyed. You can't imagine how many historic things lost in there. Irreplaceable art, artifacts, history. On the night of 28 March 1942, 234 Wellington and Stirling bombers dropped 400 tons of bombs on Lübeck, which is the town where Mrs. Scarborough came from. 1,468 buildings were destroyed, 2,180 were seriously damaged, 9,103 lightly damaged. 62% of all buildings in Lübeck damaged or destroyed. This is after they'd cleaned up when it was still smoldering. On the night of the 30th of May, 1942, Cologne was destroyed by RAF Bomber Command, the first of the 1,000 bomber raids. Cologne, famous, famous church, famous bridges, magnificent city. 2,000 tons of high explosives was delivered by 1,046 bombers in 90 minutes. Luftwaffe Commander Hermann Göring refused to believe the reports. It is impossible, he said. That many bombs cannot be dropped in a single night. But it was, as aerial photography proved. Total destruction of the city of Cologne. And you can just see the how well they built that cathedral, that anything stood after all those bombs had wrecked just about everything, blown every window out. On the 25th of June 1942, the British launched 1,067 bombers against the German port city of Bremen, like Cape Town, a port city. This air raid succeeded in killing 85 people, destroying 572 houses for the loss of 53 aircraft. So now Bomber Harris decided to send 1,000 bombers to attack the German homeland. Now, interesting, in the British newspapers, they used the word terror bombings. They were not ashamed in 1941, 43, 42, 44, 45, speaking about terror bombings. Dropping the bombs from thousands of feet up. And then notice how you dehumanize the enemy. The enemy, they're not people, they're Nazis. Even though only about 10% of the population might have been a member of the party, but nevertheless, just call everyone. You know, it's like the suggestion that every person in Russia was a communist, which of course is not true. Only 5% of Russians ever were members of the Communist Party. You can't blame everybody in the Soviet Union of being a communist any more than you could blame everyone in Germany being a Nazi. Bomber raids, terror raids. Because the Luftwaffe was not equipped with strategic bombers, the contrast between casualties caused by the Blitz in England and the saturation bombing of German cities is stark. It's not a comparison, it's a contrast. Coventry lost 100 acres through bombing in the whole war. Approximately 300 people in Coventry died by raids of the Luftwaffe throughout the whole 6 years of the war. 300. I mean, that's tragic for those 300, for sure. But the RAF bombing of Hamburg killed 70,000 civilians in a 10-day bombing raid. Between 24 July and 2 August 1943, Royal Air Force Bomber Command unleashed Operation Gomorrah against the coastal town of Hamburg in Germany. Hamburg would be equivalent to Cape Town size, a port city, beautiful medieval city. Lead bombers dropped parachute flare markers to guide the falling bombers to where to unleash their cargo of bombs in the dark. It was blackouts.
Why did they call it Gomorrah?
Sodom and Gomorrah. God rained fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to rain fire and brimstone on Hamburg. That sort of thing. So I suppose they thought RAF bomber commanders like God. 8,000-pound blockbusters, 4,000-pound cookie bombs knocked out the roofs and windows. So the first night they came over and bombed and knocked out the roofs and the windows. The next night they come and they now drop 350,000 incendiary bombs to start fires. Now the people whose homes had been bombed, they came out of the bomb shelters, came back into their homes, and now come the fires. But there's no roofs to resist it. All the fire starts are coming into the houses all over. 350,000 incendiary bombs. Crews of Halifax bombers reported a massive raging fires in Hamburg rising to 19,000 feet. Now, as they were meant to come in at 14,000 feet, they had to readjust the altitude or they'd been flying straight into flames. Imagine flames stretching that many kilometers into the sky. As the waterworks were destroyed first, there's no running water with which the fire brigade could use to extinguish the sea of flames which soon engulfed the entire city. The next day, 25 July, U.S. Army Air Force B-17 Flying Fortress bombers unleashed further destruction upon the stricken city of Hamburg. The British lost only 12 aircraft during the night raid. Now, we know today that terrorists can sometimes set a bomb and then wait until emergency services come, and then they set off another bomb, a bigger one, to get the emergency service. This is what they were doing. It's the same strategy, but on a bigger scale. Targeting the people. Wait for all emergency people to come from all around, and while the fire brigade and the nurses and doctors and medics are all busy, then they come with another raid. They did this for 10 days and nights. The Americans lost 15 aircraft during the day raid from 1,000 bombers. For 10 days and nights, the RAF and US Air Force came up a relentless day and night bombardment of the doomed city. British came by night, Americans came by day. 16,000 residential buildings in Hamburg were destroyed. Incredibly, by the end of 1943, though, the aircraft industry was back up, the chemical industry, the submarine building factories are back to almost pre-bombing capacity. However, 70,000 civilians had died in a 10-day firebombing of Hamburg. It's not even counting the pets. Just imagine the loss of life, human and animal, destroying a city. And I know people who lived through it. I've spoken to people who were in Hamburg when the bombing came. This is what happened to the port city. Can you imagine the explosive power that can lift a locomotive up in the air and drop it on the ground again? Of course, people ruined. And those who survive are also scarred. Now, I've heard it said many a time, Adolf Hitler never visited the site of any bombing. Well, here's pictures of him doing so I don't know how they can say that. But I've also read them saying he never visited people in hospital, and there's pictures of him visiting people in hospital too. So it just shows you propaganda, you can say anything you want, especially about the losing side, because if you try and defend them, then they can accuse you of all sorts of things. The enemy sees that light darken. Of course, that's where you've got blackouts. Even Rhodesia eyes brought up like that, you don't switch on the light without first closing the curtains. Of course, we weren't worried about bombers. We were concerned about terrorists, snipers, things like that. But especially at farms, you first switch off the light before you open the door. You never frame yourself against the light. And they were very serious about it. You've got to have no lights on, or you've got to have solid, heavy curtains to deadness. Because at night, they would come and they'd want to bomb your city. And you didn't want to make it easy for them to discover where your city was. Cities being targeted. I mean, just these are people's homes turned into rubble. And churches and city halls. And this is what Hamburg looked like after it cleaned up. Every roof is blown off. Churches, city halls, everything. Homes, before and after. And imagine the soldiers who come back from leave and they find that their home is gone and their family is dead. These soldiers had nothing to lose. They had every reason to fight to the end because there's nothing to come home to. Between the 13th and the 15th of February 1945, the city of Dresden was destroyed by over 2,000 bombers of the Royal Air Force and the United States Army Air Force. Dresden had been chosen as a target by the Soviets. One of the most beautiful cities in Europe. Dresden, the capital of Saxony. And, of course, we called Anglo-Saxons because, well, the Saxons that inhabited England first came from Saxony, Germany. This is what it looked like before the bombing. The Frau Kirscher in particular over here. You'll see these pictures just now with the bombing. I mean, this is before and after. This is what the city looked like. This is the Altmark and the Zinger. And you can see the Frau Kirscher to the left there, which you'll spot again just now. Beautiful, beautiful town and churches. Joseph Stalin persuaded Churchill and Roosevelt at Yalta to target Dresden, which was a major receiving area for refugees fleeing the Soviet advance on the Eastern Front. There were at least 600,000 people in the city at the time of the bombing. The city was swollen with refugees, civilians fleeing the Red Army's rapid, destructive advance. On the evening of the 13th of February 1945, 796 Lancasters and 9 de Havilland Mosquitoes delivered 1,478 tons of high explosive and 1,182 tons of incendiary bombs between 10:14 in the evening and 22 minutes past 10. So in just 8 minutes, they unleashed these thousands of tons of bombs and high explosives. 3 hours later, while the workers, the medics, the fire brigade were busy trying to save lives, another group of Lancasters arrived and dropped 1,800 tons of bombs on him. The first official reports on the air raid in Dresden describes as one of the most successful of the 1,000 bomber raids. Our pilots report there was little flak. Actually, there was no flak. They were able to make careful and straight runs of the targets without bothering much about their defenses. Well, actually, they didn't have to bother at all about defenses. This was a non-military city. A terrific concentration of fires was started in the center of the city. I've seen this film footage being shown at the Imperial War Museum when I went there last in 2014. You can actually see this. They were filming it. And you can see the moving film in color of the British filming the burning of Dresden from the sky. some of the survivors drew their depictions and experience like that. The British described this raid as one of the powerful blows promised by the Allied leaders to Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin at Yalta. The Allied bombers who were involved in the firebombing of Dresden later recalled the sense of shame that they felt when there was no anti-aircraft fire, no night fighters opposing the bombing of the city. They couldn't even feel like, well, at least we were being shot at. Numerous historians and jurists have described the bombing of the cities of Germany as a war crime and a Holocaust. This is a real Holocaust. Burning alive people. Dresden was on a river. And so many of the people leapt into the water to escape from the phosphorus. Now, phosphorus is banned by the Geneva Convention. If a piece of phosphorus bomb, you know, when you see a bomb exploding, there's all these little pieces of burning going out there. It's a chemical bomb, phosphorus bombs. They're actually illegal, although they're used by the IDF in Israel and the Gaza Strip all the time. And this is a real chemical weapon. If a piece of phosphorus falls on your skin, the only way to stop it burning is to cut off that piece of skin that's burning. There's no other way. These people would dive into the river or dive into even these water containers, although many of them boiled in. If they dived into, say, the water reservoir that they've got by their home or apartment, it cooked them alive. The water reached such intense heat. When it dived into the canal, the flame would go out. The moment they came up for air, the flame would start again. You'd go under to put out the flame, and every time, phosphorus, you can keep putting underwater, but if you bring it out to the air, it'll start burning again. And so many people drowned rather than burn to death. Phosphorus. This is what Dresden looked like afterwards, a complete destruction of a city. Yet British Air Marshal Bomber Harris, Arthur Harris, the bomber commander-in-chief responsible for the saturation bombing of civilian centers, was knighted for his efforts. Do you understand what a knighthood means? A knight in the Middle Ages had to swear to only use his skills and weapons for the defense of the innocent, to protect women and children, to never use his martial skills or weapons to injure the innocent, but always to protect women and children and civilians. And now you give a knighthood to a person who targets women and children? I mean, does the British royal family not understand what knighthood means? There are many British military who are outraged and disgusted and have protested against how could you give a man who incinerated cities, targeted civilians, a knighthood. Bomber Harris, Sir Bomber Harris, by official acclaim. And this is the result. How does this differ from Church Street bombing and car bombs of terrorists? Do you remember how after the bomb in Boston, 2013, which killed two people and injured a lot of people, President Barack Hussein Obama says nothing can justify the targeting of civilians with bombs. Anytime bombs are used to target civilians, it is terrorism. To which I say, yes and amen. At last, something I can agree with Barack Hussein Obama saying. I mean, even a stop clock's right twice a day. But then why does he cheer Nelson Mandela, who used bombs, including firebombs in Johannesburg Station to incinerate a grandmother and a granddaughter? I agree. Anytime you bomb civilians, it's terrorism. So what do you call this? What can you call this? Just imagine Cape Town being subjected to aerial bombardment like this. Killing of hundreds of thousands of people, destroying buildings that have stood for hundreds of years. The case of Dresden for sometimes a millennium. Why would you stand on a Lancaster that is primarily designed to drop bombs on cities, unless you've been so brainwashed that you think what you're doing is noble and right? This is why propaganda is so bad. Propaganda kills. Propaganda kills the conscience in a man. There should be something within a man that would never want to use his weapons or strength to injure the innocent. I could not imagine wanting to target women and children, or let alone pose for the camera proudly after having bombed a city of mainly refugees, destroying 22 hospitals in the process. And Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth unveiled this memorial for these bomber crew. These are not fighters, these are bomber crew. I don't know. These people must be seriously deluded that they could think this is honorable. But to be fair, the British propaganda industry lied to these airmen. They lied to them all the time. They continually gave them the impression to try and dehumanize the targeted enemy. News reports from neutral countries like Sweden and Switzerland were horrified. They pointed out Dresden was one large hospital city swollen with refugees fleeing the advanced Red Army. In fact, there were Swedish and Swiss Red Cross workers in the city of Dresden being incinerated by the bombers at the same time. Their citizens were being killed. This was a scandal. They also pointed out that the main railway station on the outskirts of town was unaffected by the bombing, which targeted the residential section of town. 22 hospitals destroyed in Dresden. Now, I've heard allies, supporters trying to justify the bombing of Dresden saying, well, there's a very important railway junction. Yes, but they didn't bomb the railway junction. They bombed the residential city with all the hospitals and all the refugees. One British commentator at the time asked, who the devil is going to get anything out of it? We, British, contribute the bombs and the machines and the crews who don't return from these raids. The Dresdeners themselves don't get anything out of it, naturally. The only ones who look like they're getting anything out of this are the Russians. They get Dresden at our expense. In fact, they got it for 45 years. I don't see any reason why we should go and kill people for the benefit of the Russians or the Soviets alone. Do you? And here, Winston Churchill asked Stalin, 1942, when they met together, have you forgiven me for all the horrible things I said about you? And Stalin says, it's not for me to forgive, it's for God to forgive. This kind of conversation just seems like it came out of Monty Python satire. Prime Minister of Great Britain's asking Joseph Stalin to forgive him, and Joseph Stalin, the arch-atheist communist, saying it's only for God to forgive? Here, Winston Churchill presents a crusader sword to Joseph Stalin to kill the Germans with. Now, wait a minute. Who are the Christians and who are the atheists here? Why is a prime minister of a Christian country giving a Christian crusader sword to an atheist communist who has slaughtered tens of millions of Christians already at this point of his own people, so-called? Well, alliance. These are the democracies. Unelected, but they're the democracies. Don't worry about that. Sell out to Stalin is very true. But to call it tragic errors, I think this author is deluded. These weren't tragic errors. This was deliberate policy. Churchill was not stupid. Neither is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were treacherous. That's the only word you can use for it. But just look at the... I'm wondering what Stalin's thinking. Is he thinking, what a stupid drunk? And look at the joy on their faces. I mean, the body language here. You would think they'd done something good. Now, Hollywood keeps bringing out no end of hagiography, pro-Churchill, propagandistic forms. I mean, I did a review of this exactly a year ago for the Reformation Society. Darkest Hour, what a piece of rubbish. What a bunch of lies. This man was as immoral, a chain-smoking drunk as it's possible to be. Winston Churchill in his own book said the most terrifying sound he ever heard in his life, he heard when he was a prisoner of the Boers in South Africa. The year was 1900. He's captured Natal, as he put it. And he heard the sounds of the Boers singing psalms. And he wrote, my God, what kind of enemy do we have? And then he wrote, they have the better cause. No jokes. You're invading their country and destroying their farms. Of course they've got the better cause. This is the man who's an idol in Britain, and I don't know why. He's one of the most reprehensible, low-life pieces of scum to ever inhabit the British Isles. This is a man who supported the Scorched Earth campaign of South Africa. This is a man who supported the killing of wounded soldiers after the battle in Khartoum, Omdurman, where he was. He writes about getting involved and going into the battles in Afghanistan. We left nothing alive, not a man, woman, child, or goat. We killed them all. This is a man who unleashed gas warfare on the Kurds, the Medes of Iraq, when he was colonial secretary for those areas. He drew the map of the Middle East to create countries like Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait, and so on. He drew the map as colonial secretary. So much of the mess we've got in the world today is from him. He, when he was British prime minister, organized for the CIA and the British MI6 to actually organize a coup against the elected leader of Persia, Iran, and replace him with a dictator of their own liking, just to help British Petroleum maintain higher profits. Thoroughly without any shred of principles. He organized the starving to death of millions of Indians. The Indians regard him as a war criminal. South Africans regard him as a war criminal. The Iraqis regard him as a war criminal. The Persians regard him as a war criminal. The Irish, well, what the Irish have got to say about what he did in Ireland during the Troubles and the Civil War there as well makes him a war criminal. But the Royal Air Force calls him a war criminal. He wanted the Royal Air Force to drop millions of anthrax cakes all over Germany, which would have devastated the agriculture of Europe for generations. He practiced on a Scottish island, which today is still off limits with these anthrax cakes, and which basically made the island uninhabitable by any animals, domestic or wild. This is the kind of, he wanted chemical warfare. He advocated the use of gas warfare regularly, and his own Air Force stood against him. How they have made this reprobate of no principle, a man who called himself a pagan, who even said when he was in the last years of his life, he said, death is just oblivion. There's nothing after life. He didn't believe in any of these things. He wasn't a Christian. And yet we've got Christians today idolizing him as one of the greatest men of the 20th century, the greatest Briton of all time. When Margaret Thatcher died, and I wrote, Margaret Thatcher was the greatest British prime minister of the last century. Immediately I got people saying, what about Winston Churchill? I said, well, what about him? Margaret Thatcher left Britain stronger militarily, economically, spiritually, politically. Winston Churchill destroyed Britain and the British Empire. From the time he entered the British political life in 1910 as First Lord of the Admiralty through to when he left in 1955, he had destroyed Britain. More than any other human being, he was more responsible for Britain's involvement in the First and the Second World War. He is the only member of the British War Cabinet to advocate Britain's involvement in the First World War. The entire British Cabinet, including the Prime Minister, wanted to have nothing to do with the First World War. He's the one who got them in. He's the one who was behind the Lusitania sinking and all the rest. And he advocated everything from Operation Keelhaul, betraying millions of Russian Christians and Ukrainian and Eastern European Christians handed over to NKVD of Stalin after the end of the Second World War. The treachery, the violence, what this man did to destroy the British Empire. And then his son-in-law, was it? Lord Soames handed Rhodesia over to Mugabe. Just sort of finalizes his legacy. The Dardanelles disaster is one of the most disastrous, catastrophic defeats in the history of the Royal Navy ever. He got the Royal Navy to try and charge the Dardanelles. Now, this is where you go from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea, which Turkey controlled. And so he ordered the Navy to fight the forts. And first dictum of Royal Navy doctrine by Lord Nelson is ships do not fight forts. Forts can always have, forts are stronger than ships, and forts have bigger cannons than ships. Forts are not to be fought by ships. He sends in the Royal Navy and they lose just about all of their everything. It's just total catastrophe. And then he compounds that by sending in Australians and New Zealanders, and they get wiped out by the tens of thousands. Disaster. Disaster. Patrick Buchanan wrote this book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. Been through this book several times. Excellent. Showing that Churchill was the greatest disaster to ever hit the British Empire. And pointing out how many worthless wars America's got involved in because of idolizing Churchill. The Churchill cult has gotten America involved in how many worthless wars? Because everybody is a Hitler, and everybody trying to argue for peace is a Chamberlain appeaser, and every American president wants to be a Churchill, and that's what's led to the Iraq War, the Gulf War I, the Gulf War II, the war with Syria, Afghanistan, on and on. It's the Churchill cult that actually has led to so many disastrous wars of America that has destroyed the lives of millions of Christians in the Middle East. The original church, these are the incendiary bombs coming out of the Lancaster. This is the Mosquito, very fast-moving plane. a fighter bomber. Destroyed, rebuilt. The Church of Our Lady has become a symbol of Dresden's reconciliation. There's the Luther statue outside the Frauenkirche, and you can see before and after. 1945, the view from the city hall, the Rathaus, over the destroyed city. Statue of Martin Luther pleading with the people. Luther's monument blown off its stand. They repaired the statue before they repaired their church. Well, you start with what you can do. But this is symbolic to me of the Reformation work we've got to do. So much of Christian civilization is in ruins, like Dresden. We need to rebuild Christian civilization brick by brick, family by family, life by life, renewing minds, changing lives, just as these courageous women rebuilt Dresden. The men couldn't, because the men were in slave camps across the Soviet Union, dying in Arctic hellholes over the next 10 years under Stalin. But today, you go to Dresden, they've rebuilt it all to original specs. I mean, this is determination. This is what Reformation is all about. And here in 2005, they rededicated the church. Around 1,600 participated in a torchlit march in the eastern city of Dresden on the anniversary of the city's bombardment by the Allies, pointing out, remembering the 500,000 killed in this bombing. Yes. Yeah, they're dropping bombs, looking at coffins. This is a wise use of art. People oscillated as they watched the Dresden 1945 360-degree panorama showing the destroyed city of Dresden after the bombing raids in February 1945. Inside the Frauenkirche, destroyed during the war, they rebuilt it to literally from the ashes. The castle rebuilt. The Stemruppe, the state opera house, destroyed, rebuilt. Dresden has been rebuilt extraordinarily. But an Associated Press radio report put out by Paris was broadcast throughout the United States describing the deliberate terror bombings of German population centers. Again, they were quite open. These are terror bombings. We wanted to terrorize them. We want to break the will to resist. Carried out by heavy bombers of the Allied Air Force on residential sections of Berlin and Dresden, with unprecedented day and night assault on a refugee crowd capital, with civilians fleeing the Red Titan East. This is the British and American press reports. Americans had traditionally viewed with suspicion the RAF Bomber Command's strategy of bombing cities. Now Americans were learning that American bombers were involved in the same terror raids on civilians. The report noted that as all available German air forces were concentrating Eastern Front to combat the Red Army offensive, which threatened to destroy all of Germany and Europe, the targeting of civilian centers in Germany seemed exceptional cowardice. Just like we thought when we're fighting communists on the border in Angola and you've got these UCT students throwing rocks and causing fires in Cape Town, you think, do they realize who they're helping or what they're undermining? And this was what Dresden looked like afterwards. And they're still digging corpses out of the ruins years later. This is a genuine Holocaust. And to go and bomb people just hours after they've already been bombed, and then to come and bomb them again hours after that. As this AP news report was widely broadcast by radio throughout the United States, General Eisenhower and General Henry Arnold cabled General Spatz to clarify that the United States Army Air Force was only targeting military objectives, not engaging in error bombing of cities. General Carl Spatz gave an ambiguous and dishonest assurance that the United States Army Air Force only attacked military objectives. Yes, but the cities were the military objectives. This, of course, wasn't true, that they weren't attacking civilians. That was the whole purpose of bombing of cities. But the civilians back in America, preparing the arsenal for democracy, they assumed these were being used for military purposes. How many mothers would have been happy to build bombs that's going to be used for killing civilians and other mothers in another city? This was just incredible. Flying over infernos. Worse than that, the Americans who came by day in Valentine's Day, 1945, were ordered to strafe and machine gun the civilians on the streets, the people working, whether they ambulance workers, strafe them, machine gun them. And they had these Mustangs, fighter jets, prop planes, but they could fly very fast. And they came and they strafed the people on the ground. The bombers the gun crews were ordered to machine gun the people on the ground to create maximum havoc. Why? The Red Army is attacking and they're only a few miles from the city. Create chaos behind makes it easy for the Red Army to take the whole thing. American historian Professor Harry Elmer Barnes wrote, "It was the indiscriminate bombings of civilians by so-called strategic air forces during the Second World War which culminated in the destruction of Dresden, a wholly non-military objective in February 1945." Just somebody's painted this, and all of these factors are true. People on fire, literally on fire, from phosphorus. This completely pulverized the code of civilized warfare and returned the treatment of military opponents and civilians to the level of the primal warfare that had prevailed amongst savages, the Assyrians, and the medieval Mongols. We thought we were better than that. I was brought up to be taught that the British play fair. We play by the rules of the game. We were told in Rhodesia we're more British than the British. We've got British sense of fair play, British sense of honor. You don't kick a man when he's down. There's all sorts of honor that we were taught. This was not the way the Second World War was portrayed to us. I don't like being lied to. On the base of the most authoritative British sources, Mr. Veal demonstrates clearly it was the British, not the Germans, who introduced indiscriminate strategic bombing of cities despite the efforts of Hitler to avert this reversion to barbaric praxis. This doesn't fit the narrative because Hitler's the ultimate bad guy. He's the Satan of our time. And, you know, we've got a whole new religion these days, and it's not the cross that's sent, it's a gas chamber. And the new Satan is Hitler, and anyone else called Hitler, like Saddam Hussein, Assad, whatever. I mean, you know, this just keeps changing. Oh, for Voot, Ian Smith, doesn't matter. They have made evil now into whatever opposes the New World Order. But Hitler actually tried to have an agreement at the beginning of the war that no cities would be bombed and to leave civilian centers out. But the British wanted to break this, and they chose. Look at this archaeological footage of the destruction of the inner city of Dresden. These are pictures taken by planes that flew over the place afterwards to document the entire city. I mean, can you imagine? Not a roof left, not a home unscathed, not a church left standing. That's just one of 61 cities. The German towns of Kassel suffered over 300 air raids, some by 1,000 bomber raids, British by day, British by night, Americans by day. I've been in the center of Kassel. I've seen these areas. When the 4th of April 1945, the city surrendered, barely 15,000 people remained of the original population of 250,000. Wiener Neustadt in Austria emerged from the air raids with only 18 houses intact and its population of 45,000 reduced to just 860 survivors. This is what bombing could look like. The London Times review of the British official history of the strategic air offensive commented, "One closes these volumes feeling uneasy that the true heroes of the story they tell are neither the contending air marshals nor even the 58,888 officers and men of Bomber Command who were killed in action." Now, remember, this is the London Times review. The heroes were the inhabitants of the German cities under attack. The men, women, and children who stoically endured and worked on amongst the flaming ruins of their homes and factories up till the moment when the Allied armies overran them. London Times to write that. That's quite extraordinary. This is the kind of propaganda coming out during the Second World War. Kill all Germans. Men, women, children, old, young. This is the propaganda. The soldiers and the airmen were being pumped full of such a hatred. And do you know what it sounds like? Kill the Boer. Kill the farmer. Whites aren't humans. Kill them all. So on and so forth. It's the same sort of thing. You demonize your target enemy. I heard this in Rwanda. The Tutsi are Inyenzis. They're cockroaches. We must clear the bush. You see, the Tutsis aren't real human beings. They're not real people. Kill them all. Dehumanize the enemy. Propaganda justifies in the minds of the aggressor that he is so much more morally justified in performing any atrocity against these targets and dehumanized people. In the course of watching a British propaganda film showing the bombing of German cities from there, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill suddenly sat bolt upright and asked Lord Casey, "Are we beasts? Are we taking this too far?" So he actually had something of a semblance of conscience, or at least a flicker of it for a few moments. On the 11th of February, 1944, the Bishop of Chichester, George Bell, caused an uproar in the House of Lords when he made a speech challenging the morality of area bombing of German cities. "I recognize the legitimacy of concentrated attack on industrial and military objectives, on airfields and air bases, in view especially of the coming of the Second Front. I fully recognize that in attacks on centers of war industry and transport, the killing of civilians when it is the result of bona fide military activity is inevitable. But there must be a fair balance between the means employed and the purpose achieved. To obliterate a whole town because certain portions contain military industrial establishments is to reject the balance. How can there be discrimination in such matters when civilians, monuments, military objectives, and industrial objectives all together form the target? How can the bombers aim at anything more than a great space when they see nothing and the bombing is blind? How can the war cabinet fail to see that this progressive devastation of cities is threatening the roots of civilization?" Brave man in the House of Lords, a minister of the gospel, Bishop of Chichester. Throughout the world, there were shockwaves of revulsion against bombing of Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, Berlin. And this compelled the propaganda ministries to seek to generate as much counter-accusations of atrocities against the enemy to justify the targeting of whole cities for destruction. But what could compare with incinerating whole cities and killing hundreds of thousands of men, women, children? Soon, pictures of starving inmates of labor camps were being published widely. Well, it's been shown, this is photo. Shot this picture without, but all these people are quite normal, but this man is photoshopped in. Anyway, the fact that the starvation was caused by the Royal Naval blockade and the aerial bombardment of Germany was, of course, not pointed out. It was pointed out to me by General Ben Parton, first month I was in America, January 1988. He said, "We had bombed the hell out of Germany. We bombed every single factory, every single railway, every single bridge, every railway junction. They were starving. We'd blockade them for years. Everyone was starving in Germany in 1945. Of course, people in labor camps would also be starving. But who had starved them? We'd bombed electricity, bombed the plumbing, bombed everything. Of course, people were starving. They were starving because of our bombardment." But the pictures were shown out of context to blame the German people is innately evil because here's some starving people. I can show you pictures of more starving people, more skeletal people in the Bloemfontein Women's Monument Museum of the Anglo-Boer War caused by the British in South Africa. And the British can't say they were starving because somebody was bombing us. The British controlled everything, the railways, the whole lot, and they deliberately starved the Boer women and children in those camps. But that doesn't prove gas chambers or concentration camps having a policy of liquidation. So what did the starving figures prove? Well, it showed that everyone was starving in Germany at this end of the Second World War because this is what the Allies had done. They'd bombed the hell out of everything and every city and every railway station and every junction. How could food, water, electricity, medicines, or anything move? Of course there were people dying of starvation there after this kind of destruction. So it took an American Air Force general to point out to me the people starving in these camps were starving because of our policy. The epidemics of typhus had erupted. Here's a British soldier at Dachau with dust spreads typhus 5 kilometers now. Yeah, well, typhus was what was killing people. Even pictures of German civilians laid out in the center of bombed out towns like the Altmark of Dresden were published in Life magazine with the caption, "These are Jewish victims of German death camps." But look, look at the brick buildings, the multiple-story buildings behind. And look here, this is the Altmark. This is Dresden. They brought the victims of Allied bombings to burn them because there wasn't enough space to bury them. They couldn't cope with the amount of bodies to be buried. They burned them. And these pictures were used close-up and said, "Jewish victims of German Holocaust." But actually, they were German victims of American and British Holocaust. Look at this picture. I've been shown this as part of a Eisenhower documenting the Holocaust picture show. But look at these bomb buildings. This isn't a concentration camp. This is a city. These people are victims of bombings, Allied bombings. But they depict this as German Holocaust of poor innocent Jews who mind their own business. Whereas actually, it's German civilians who are trying to mind their own business, killed by Allied bombing. And the surrounding shows that. If you just look at the bombed out buildings, you can see this. These aren't wooden bungalows. These are proper buildings in the city bombed out. And then you look at some of the pictures of the people in concentration camps that have been liberated, and they don't look starving. Not all of them are starving. Some surely were. American soldiers in Dachau had German civilians drag victims of typhus into the showers, and Americans then claimed these showers had been gas chambers. Later, all parties agreed there'd never been a gas chamber at Dachau, and Americans were ordered to dismantle a structure they'd built off the war to show tourists. This here, gas, aware, they don't tell you, this picture, which was used for propaganda to prove the gas chambers, was actually at the laundromat for Zyklon B to get rid of the typhus lice on the insecticide being used in the laundry. But they don't show you that. By then, virtually all the prison wardens at Dachau weren't even prison wardens. They were Waffen-SS who had been just told to hand over the camp to the Americans who were coming, and the prison guards had fled. Well, all the soldiers who were drafted to hand the camp over were just massacred by the American forces for the crime that they now admitted never took place there. Now, all, even the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, admit there's no gas chambers in any German camps. The only ones they maintained were in Poland. But these were places, this is in Germany, in Bavaria, Dachau, which was, they shot all the soldiers who were there, out of hand, massacred the prisoners, admitted, open, they took pictures of it, weren't ashamed of that. The Allied bombers were the architects of the Holocaust. Saturation bombing destroyed German infrastructure, which resulted in starvation, disease, and the concentration camps. And I have this point out to me by an American Air Force general. The American judge at the Nuremberg trials, Nicholas Biddle, later acknowledged Germany waged a much cleaner war than we did. That's a shock, because we told the opposite. Winston Churchill even acknowledged that had Germany won the war, he could have been tried as a war criminal for having authorized the bombing of cities. Indeed, he was a war criminal. The Hague Convention of 1899 and 1907 set rules in place regarding the attack of civilian populations. It forbade it. The Hague Convention of 1907. The Hague Convention stated religious buildings, art and science centers, charities, hospitals, and historic monuments are to be spared as far as possible in any bombardment unless they're being used for military purposes. In other words, if you're besieging a city, if there's bombing going on, you can't be targeting these. You can only target that which is being used for military purposes. The Hague Convention also prohibited the employment of arms, projectiles, or material calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Lord Trenchard, once declared, "I can't write what I mean, I can't say what I mean, but I expect you to know what I mean." Lord Trenchard, Royal Air Force people, he's got a monument too, this architect of saturation bombing of cities. And no wonder the Spanish depicted both Churchill and Roosevelt as pirate gangsters. The official historian of strategic air offensive, Sir Charles Webster, noted that half of the bomber sorties made over Germany were a complete waste of time. The weapon with which most British bombers were armed, the general purpose bomb, was so unreliable, so ineffective as to constitute a waste of strategic resources. Between 1939 and 1945, Bomber Command dropped over 500,000 pound general purpose bombs, nearly 150,000 250 pound general purpose bombs. Not only were these bombs unsuited for the task for which they were used because of the general characteristics, which constitute an unhappy compromise between strength of casing and weight of explosive, but they're also relatively inefficient and also often defective weapons. It was estimated that nearly 40% of all the bombs dropped by the British in 1940 failed to explode. 40%, which is roughly what was in the First World War with artillery shells too, in the first year. Even the 4,000-pound bombs frequently broke up on impact without even exploding. It was observed that Bomber Command wasted thousands of air crews' lives carrying defective bombs to Germany, which is described as bad as sending men to battle with their rifles loaded with blanks. Obviously, I don't think the bombs were meant to be. I mean, I don't think it's good to blow people up with bombs. But from their perspective, the Air Force saying, why were we sending men over there to get shot down and killed to drop bombs that didn't even explode? So, not saying it wasn't better that they didn't explode, but he's making a point. It's now clear that Generals DeWitt and Trenchard were wrong. Bombers did not win the war. You can now safely say that not only did bombing of cities not shorten the duration of the Second World War, but the strategic bombing campaign actually prolonged the war and exponentially increased the death toll that war, and also gave the German soldiers no reason to surrender. There's nothing to come home to. They'd lost their families. More German civilians were killed in the war than German soldiers in the battlefront. By the way, just for a bit of a picture of what life was like in Germany beforehand, they had the highest standards of living in the world. Autobahns, culture, the Reichstag, this German parliamentary buildings, Olympic theater. This is the Olympics in 1936. Germany was host to the most efficient Olympics the world had ever seen, and people for the first time saw color television. Not just television, color television, all sorts of things. What the Germans organized there, it created the envy of the world, as they won most of the gold medals, most of the silver. They won more medals than Britain and America combined. And there was such hatred. In fact, many people said from 1936, the knives were in, they were going to destroy this country because it had the highest standards of living in the world, the best cars, the best everything. Michael Walsh has written a book, Life in the Reich, speaking about life in Hitler's Germany for the 6 years before the war in particular, where he looks at the standard of living. Now, these are just some pictures of like the Unterlinden in Germany and the sidewalk cafes. Remember, this is 1930s. Life in Germany before the bombing. Look at the highly advanced railway prototypes, the types of cars, the ocean voyages, the ice skating, all sorts of things, the youth, the fitness emphasis, the camps, modeled. The Hitler Youth, by the way, was modeled totally on Baden-Powell's scouts, totally. And these are some of the people who were, of course, bombed and killed in the war. There never was a society so free of debt as Germany. Do you know, if you had one child, you got a quarter of your debt of your new house cut off. If you had four children, all debts cancelled, you now owned your house. Four children born. And the standard of living was so high, the hatred. Now, it was pointed out by Stephen Mitford Goodson, an economist who's director of the Southern Reserve Bank, that Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and Emperor Hiroshima's Japan in the 1930s were the only countries in the world without a Rothschild-controlled central bank. Total coincidence, I'm sure. But this is this beautiful Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church where Daniela Sangen, it was destroyed in the bombing. They've had to rebuild it since. This beautiful cathedral in Germany, the Dom in Berlin, just get a bit of a feel for what the cities were like before they were bombed, and the order and the types of people and the clean living attitudes of these people. My daughter got a lot of hate mail for posting this picture from We Love God's Animals because it happens to be a German soldier being kind to this kitten during a time of war. That's how brutal hate crimes are these days. You're not even allowed to show a nice picture advising kindness to animals. There are books that have dominated the Allied attempt to exterminate Germany after the war was over. The destruction of Germany. Do you know more Germans died after the war was over than during the war? The death toll of Germany between 1945 and 1948 tops 18 million killed under the Allies under occupation. This has been well documented. This is the cathedral Daniela Sangen. It's a wreck. The Unterlinden by the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. I've driven around here many times, and it's extraordinary. They rebuilt everything. This is what their parliament building looked like. Just imagine. Unwilling to face the German soldier on the battlefield, these strategists were prepared to drop bombs on his family from a safe height of over 10,000 feet. Sort of like Milner and Lord Kitchener, unable to defeat the Boer commanders in the field, took the war to their families and the farms. This indirect way of winning a war proved to be an illusion. Over 2 million people were killed and millions more injured and crippled as a result. the strategic bombing of cities not only proved to be unethical, but counterproductive. According to Geoffrey Perrot in Winged Victory, the Army Air Forces in World War II, General Carl Spatz, commander of the Strategic Air Force, ordered the 8th Army Air Force to strike Berlin. Not the industries of Berlin, not the marshalling yards of the railways, but the city centre, heart of Germany, an area of high population density. Perrot writes that General Doolittle, the famous hero of the Doolittle Raid, protested that such an attack would be terrorism without any justification on military grounds. You can only agree with that. I took this picture at the Imperial War Museum 2014, and it speaks about the British investing heavily. Before 1939, this is the British Imperial War Museum. Before 1939, Britain invested heavily in new bombing aircraft. The Royal Air Force persuaded the government that bombing key strategic industrial targets would be vital to winning any future war. From 1940 to 44, strategic bombing was the only way which Britain could strike directly at Germany, and from 1941, support its Soviet ally on the Eastern Front. This isn't my theory. This is what the British are saying in their own Imperial War Museum. At the Imperial War Museum, they've got this tale from a German fighter ace, Major Heinz Schnaufer, one of the most successful night fighter pilots. He shot down 121 British bombers, including 59 Lancasters, equal to 5 entire squadrons. He was responsible for about 850 RAF casualties, probably 700 were killed. 1945 April, his Bf 110 fighter was destroyed on the ground. He obtained another and had his 121 victories painted in tail fin. He left this Bf 110 for the British to find when over in his field. Schnaufer flew in defense of the enemy bombers flying over German towns. This is the British Royal Air Force display in the Imperial War Museum. This is what they say. Heinz Schnaufer flew in the defense against the enemy bombers flying to attack German towns. With every one of the more than 120 bombers he shot down, hence prevented from dropping their bombs, he saved the lives of countless innocent and defenseless human beings. Every time he flew in his operations, he knew he was risking his life. That we should honor and remember Heinz Schnaufer is no more than he deserves. And this is in the British Imperial War Museum. You know, even a stop clock is right twice a day. And I wouldn't want to end on a negative note. Let me end on a very positive note. This is a picture taken of an actual incident that occurred in over the skies of Germany just before Christmas. This heavily damaged B-17 is being escorted by Messerschmitt 109 flown by Franz Steigler, 1943, just 3 days before Christmas. This, you see this aircraft shot to pieces. One of its engines shut down. Lots of holes, tail shot out, the tail gun is killed. The captain of this plane was Charlie Brown. That's his actual name. He was Lieutenant Charlie Brown from America, and he was facing Franz Steigler, a German fighter ace who had been North Africa. He had fought in Battle of Britain. He had fought in North Africa. He was a friend of Marseille, one of the greatest fighter aces, and Adolf Garland and many others. And he was angry because he had seen the bombing of the cities, his own family was being bombed. He got up there with murder in his heart, just wanted to shoot down this cursed American bomber. But when he saw this plane, here's Charlie Brown, Franz Steigler, many years later, with an artist to design this. When he saw this, he felt pity on him, and he helped escort him out over the German AKAC coastal guns, directed him the correct way to get back to England, saluted and saw him off. And they became friends and fishing buddies later. Now, when he was asked how he could do this, they both signed this aircraft, he said, I was told by my commander, you never shoot a pilot in a parachute. In fact, his commander says, if I find you shooting a man in a parachute, I'll kill you myself. He said, you don't stand by a high code for the sake of the enemy, but for your own sake, that you don't lower yourself to their level. You have to maintain a higher standard. Even though there's a bomber, who'll probably come back and bomb us again, he had a higher call. And as he was there and he's looking, he had his finger over the trigger. He took his hand off and he felt his crucifix on his, he prayed and he went around, guided him, saluted him, and saw him off to safety. On the other side, Charlie Brown was praying and holding his pocket Gideon's New Testament in his hand. The whole story has been put together, the most magnificent book. It's going to come out as dramatic film one of these days. When you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees. Deuteronomy 20 verse 19 makes it clear, when we're in warfare, we're meant to adhere to a high standard. Franz Steigler showed that kind of standard. And you can sometimes go past the standards of the day. Praise God, there's a lot of people like that. My father spoke about, after every battle in North Africa, there'd be an unspoken understanding of ceasefire. They'd walk past. The British medics would be caring for German Africa Corps. German Africa Corps people were caring for and carrying on stretcher of the British wounded back to, and there was a cooperation because they understood we're all facing the same dust storms, sandstorms, heat, trench rocks, all the different, the flies, the mosquitoes and everything else. And there was a sympathy. In fact, they said we felt more solidarity with our enemy than we did with our people and family back home. I've heard that from many soldiers. Among the dead cities, was the Allied bombing of civilians in World War II a necessity or a crime? David Irving blew the lid off with the destruction of Dresden Book, which was the first time anyone knew that such a thing took place. This was hidden for over 20 years. This came out in the 60s, and he's updated it since. The Devil's Handiwork, A Victim's View of Allied War Crimes, Targeting Civilians in War, Bombing, a 20th Century History, Bombing Civilians, The Thousand Bomber Raids, Birth of the Allied Blitz. I remember reading this book, and this hero worships and makes it seem like a good thing. Cover of Darkness, The Thousand Plan, the first Thousand Bomber Raid in Cologne. And this they made into a movie, making it out like a wonderful thing, stirring music. Target for Tonight, You Buy 'em, We Fly 'em. Defense War Bonds. By the way, notice these are all pictures of fighter planes. People are more likely to support fighters defending yourself, but most of the money was going to bombers. See how propaganda, you can just have a slight shift. Bomber Boys, Fighting Back. Well, actually, they're the ones who initiated the fight. They were bombing Germany from the 4th of September, 1939 already. The Munster Raid, Bloody Skies Over Germany. Well, bloody skies, what about the bloody cities on the ground because of their bombs? The Munster Raid, before and after. Bombing of Nuremberg. Operation Gomorrah, Dresden. The Devil's Tinderbox, The Destruction of Dresden. If you want to see a dramatic film on it, and it's very well made, Dresden, we've got it on the library. It's all in German and English. The English speak English, German speak German with subtitles. So it's perfectly understandable. It's very, very, very well made. And I must say, it struck me because the key nurse looks so much like my mother, who's a nurse as well. And to see it from the perspective of a nurse who ends up protecting this Allied bomber who is shot down, who's disguised as Wehrmacht in order to get into a hospital and get the care he needs for his wounds. And she falls in love with this British bomber pilot, which initially her reaction is revulsion. You're a bomber pilot. She's willing to help him because she first thinks he's a spy. When she realizes a bomber pilot, it turns into revulsion. But I mean, that's the thing. It just shows the conflict. And for myself, having a German mother and English father who on opposite sides, this film hit very close. But anyway, this is a dramatic film that, for its weaknesses, it still depicts what a firebombing does on the ground. But it holds back from showing the American bombing in the morning. It shows the two British bombings at night, spaced out. But it stops at that point. But the thing is, the trauma didn't stop. It carried on. And the British came back again the next night too. Carried on from the 13th to the 15th. This film only looks at the bombings on the night of the 13th, in the aftermath of the morning of the 14th, before the American and British continuation came. Yeah, daring missions that changed the shape of World War II. Yeah, but it didn't win the war. And these are, Horido is a story of a German fighter pilot Achtung Stücke. I remember reading about the Luftwaffe night fighter pilots. Adolf Garland was one of the night fighters. And interesting, he had his foreword written by the British squadron leader, Douglas Bader. And Douglas Bader wrote the foreword for his book. He wrote the foreword for Douglas Bader's book. So, and they would do family holidays together. That's RAF and Luftwaffe, who became best of friends afterwards. Freedom Betrayed goes even further behind the scenes of the treachery of the politicians who engineered the war. Peter Padfield's book, Hess, Hitler, and Churchill, The Real Turning Point of the Second World War, is also an important perspective. But one book that I've still got to turn into lectures, which was a phenomenal read, The Secret War. It's a study of the Second World War from the perspective of the intelligence agencies of the secret files being sealed for 60 years, like GCHQ, British Intelligence. And you find out what was known and what really happened. And as the general who did the foreword said, The Secret War by Max Hastings is going to require every single book and film and documentary of the Second World War to be rewritten, because it basically blows the lid on so many presuppositions and falsehoods. Other secrets have been brought out earlier, like Operation Keelhaul, the massacres of Russians, Ukrainians, and other East Europeans by allies, forcing them back into Stalin's hands. James Bach's book, Other Losses, the shocking truths of how the Allies killed more German soldiers after the war in prison camps than they died in the whole 6 years of the war in battle. The Crimes and Mercies, James Bach, documents a huge amount of the horror that was perpetrated by the Allies on the Germans after the war was over. Huge amounts of murder of German people all over. There were concentration camps set up in Poland mainly, run by Jews to torture German civilians, mostly women. And these things have only recently come out because they've been suppressed for so long. After the Reich, this brutal history of Allied occupation is something that obviously has been suppressed for years. Michael Walsh has brought a whole lot of Witness to History catastrophe books out. Professor Rummel documents death by government well. So these are just some of the sources I've used to be able to try and get the other side of the story for this. So, any comments or questions? The bombing of cities in World War II. This really grew a lot from what I'd originally planned, but as you can see, I've taken a few side stories.
I just remember my mom, she was from East Prussia, New Gdansk, helping, and they had to flee the Russian tanks. They had to flee, and they made it over the ferry to Copenhagen, and they ended up in a camp. It was first a prisoner of war camp, but they changed it to a refugee camp. They were stationed there, the whole family. Apart from the father, who was in the war. And then the Danish threw them out in the middle of winter over to North Germany and to walk back through the whole of North Germany down to the south, in winter time, in the freezing cold. And one sister picked up a bomb splitter and sprinted in Essen, and they went through there. The bomb went off somehow. Hospital of splinters and so on. They had to flee with basically nothing.
My mother's experience too. 11 years old. Canadians took their home in Minden. First black person she saw was a Canadian soldier. Had a knife to her throat. Threatened to kill her. She didn't point out where the family jewels were hidden. And fortunately she was rescued by a Canadian officer. But they threw them out, but before they left, because they decided to take over their home, they decided to carry all the cutlery and everything to the top and smash it down, and they even hoisted up the grand piano from the ground floor to the third floor to smash it down for them to see everything smashed. Made a fine, burned their family pictures, things like this. Canadians. Why would they do that? Because they had been so propagandized to believe that the German people, even civilians, were not human, didn't deserve any compassion. So propaganda kills. And to see it being done today in this country by the EFF, BLF, ANC and others, dehumanizing people so that you can steal, kill, whatever you want, and it's all justifiable. Propaganda kills. And this kind of hate that gets fostered, it ends up in the end with somebody actually carrying it out to the end degree like this.
Mm-hmm. And the guy said that this is the only war in the history that we don't fight for money, but for the lives of people. And that was also, he was...
Oh, what a lot of rubbish. What absolute lies. But again, they demonized the South, and that's why atrocities could be done, like my Sherman's march through Georgia and so on. And this is why in America they had people like... Who's the famous train robber, outlaw, Jesse James? Jesse James became an outlaw who only targeted Yankee railways and Yankee banks. And they'd hung his father, stepfather, multiple times till he lost his mind and his brain damage. Blew up his mom, so she lost her arm. Blew up his home. Killed his young brother. I think 12 or 13. And so at age 15, Jesse James went out and became an outlaw, and he fought a continuation war against the Yankees. Now, he's, according to the Southerners, he's a resistance fighter against the Yankees. According to the Yankees, he's a criminal. But why did he do it? Because of how the Northerners waged a vicious war against the people in their state was just Missouri, was it? Yes. The South didn't just have 4 years war. Some place like Missouri had 14 years of terrorism by the Northerners and run by the banks and by the railway people. And the Pinkertons were part of it. And it was the Pinkertons who actually bombed his family home, killed his brother, crippled his mom before he went to being a bank robber and a train robber. So you understand that background, it suddenly makes you look at Jesse James different. And this is the point. Context changes. Everything has a context. Nothing happens in a vacuum. And so, again, why did the Second World War take place? You've got to understand the First World War and the Versailles Treaty, and so on. But how could allies, people we know, have done atrocities like this? Because they believed the propaganda. And so the end result of propaganda like they're unleashing against white farmers and Afrikaners today in this country is going to have colossally bad consequence, because you can't tell lies long enough without it having a consequence. Somebody's going to act on those lies. Like these people who thought that they did a good thing bombing, and now they make films glamorizing the bombers. How can it be terrorism to kill two people in Boston, but not terrorism to kill a few hundred thousand people in Dresden?
Why? Okay, so you're saying that Hitler, like he actually made Germany a better place for a few years. You said that the camps that the Jews were put in were not like, they didn't have gas chambers and stuff like that. But why did he put them there?
Okay, now, obviously, I was born 1960. I wasn't around back then, and I can't say for sure a whole lot of things. Some things from historical research evidence we come out with. But we've got to question something when there's laws forbidding you investigating. Truth does not fear investigation. When you can go to jail for producing scientific, biological, and so on research into the chemical properties of Zyklon B and so on, when 55,000 people could be locked up in Germany, including a great-grandmother, Ursula Havelbeck, 87 years old, they locked her up now for the third time because she denies the gas chambers and so on, says she doesn't believe it. Well, even if she's wrong, why do you need to put a person in jail? I don't think people should be put in jail for questioning the flood, Noah's Ark, the crucifixion, the resurrection of Christ, or the existence of God. I like to debate them with facts and argue with objective evidence. I don't believe you should lock people up for denying creation or the resurrection or the Trinity. So the fact that we've now got a new religion, Holocaustianity, where the only unforgivable sin is to question their version of what happened, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who spent 14 years in concentration camps of the Soviets, said, everyone knows about the 6 million Jews supposedly killed by the Germans, but who speaks about the 66 million Christians killed by the Jews in Russia? And this is the point. You can tell who runs our media when you're not allowed to speak about the persecution of Christians in communist countries, but they can make thousands of films and documentaries and books and all the rest of it on what happened to Jews without you being allowed to question any aspect or even why they were locked up. Okay, so why were Boer women and children locked up in concentration camps in South Africa? Why were Japanese locked up in concentration camps in America? Why were all Germans in Britain locked up in concentration camps during the First and Second World War? Why were all Germans in the United States put into concentration camps in America during the war? Why are there Christians in concentration camps in China today? Well, countries tend to take people they perceive as enemies and put them into camps where they can control them, force them to be laborers, slaves, whatever. And sometimes they may even have the intention to kill them all, such as has happened in the Soviet Union, or the goal of Milner's concentration camps for the Boers here in South Africa, which still has the highest death toll of any concentration camps in history. No concentration camps killed a quarter of the total population every year, except the British ones in South Africa. So they still have the world record, worst death rate, percentage-wise, of any concentration camps in history, even worse than Auschwitz. So plainly, the situation is not black and white. I'm not standing up to say anything for Adolf Hitler. The point is, we don't even know that much about him except what his enemies have said afterwards, and because he lost in the war, you can't hear any defending side of it. So, fair enough. Maybe he's guilty of all the things they say. But that doesn't justify bombing of cities and civilians and taking people who were in the camps. Some people were in the camps the whole time and survived. Well, it couldn't have been a death camp. If you are taken to a camp and there's medical checkups and there's vaccinations and they tattoo you with the numbers to track you, and there are people like Corrie ten Boom who got released from the camp and officially released during the war and sent back home. A death camp doesn't have survivors. It doesn't have hairdressing salons, swimming pools, everything from orchestra, cinema, and so on and so forth, dental surgeries, marriages, every kind of interesting thing was going on in these camps as well. So it couldn't be just a death camp. Did people die in those camps? Obviously. Why did they die? Well, maybe it was typhus, maybe it was starvation. Some people probably were shot, some people were hung. Were any people gassed? Well, where's the evidence? And we've got people such as gas chamber engineer who went in, an American gas chamber engineer, who came out and said none of these gas chambers could ever be used for gas executions, and not now, not ever, and swore that in the Canadian court. So you've got some of those saying that it's just not possible and giving all sorts of reasons for it from a scientific point of view. Now, maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but why would you lock up people like engineers and biochemists in Austria and Germany for questioning these things and writing dissertations? Truth doesn't fear investigation. So I don't know all that happened in the Second World War. There's a few things I've been able to investigate and get somewhat to the bottom of. I've got more questions than answers in the whole lot of it. But I know this much. A lot of the people giving the official version are pathological liars. They're the same ones who told us for years that the Germans killed the Polish officers at Katyn, whereas now we know the Soviets did it, and so on. And that they always knew this, but they were happy to hang Germans for things that they knew the Russians had done at Nuremberg. So there's all kinds of dishonesty. To unravel the lies of the Second World War will take a long time.
How do we get truth from the lies?
Well, just look at the consequences. Lies have terrible consequences. You can switch off the check there. I think if you just consider, how many of you have seen the film Black Knight, Dark Knight, Dark Knight? It's a Batman movie.
Yeah.
Batman movie, Harvey Dent's the hero. Actually, Harvey Dent becomes Scarface, Two-Face, and
yeah.
he does a whole lot of horrible things. But Batman takes the rap for the murders that Harvey Dent did, so that the people can idol worship Harvey Dent, who's actually the bad guy in the end, because he thinks that the truth would be too painful. It's more comforting for him to be alive. But in worshipping the criminal Harvey Dent, the whole city of Gotham City gets corrupted and becomes wrecked. And after a while, Batman's got to realize he's enabled this destruction of Gotham City because he's gone with a lie, enabling him to hero worship someone as a hero is actually a criminal. I believe that's what's happened to Western civilization. We've idolized the Second World War, the worst war in history, as the good war. And we have believed all sorts of lies about people who've been heroized, whether it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King Jr., or Nelson Mandela, idolizing as heroes, people who are anti-Christian. And it can't but rot your soul when you do this. And demonizing people who are decent people, who are honorable people, who are fighting communism and so on. And then glamorizing a class of terrorism, bombing cities. Now, I'm not saying every single pilot and person in those planes understood the implications of what they were doing. Many of them were young people in trusty governments and thought that obeying orders they were doing something good. But the fact is, you can't possibly justify the bombing of cities. Ever. You can't ever justify the bombing of civilians. You can't justify the targeting of civilians in any war. And so I think we have rotted our soul by idolizing an evil war and evil means and evil men, and that has to be put right. This doesn't mean that you take the other side of everything. It just means that we've got to get balance here. As Christians, I mean, I can no longer feel like I did as a kid, cheering the dam busters who bomb a dam, and it ends up showing whole towns coming under flood, and of course people are drowning. I mean, you're drowning people and babies in the cot, and we think that's a good thing? And they sort of rousing music as the bombs are falling, and Memphis Belle, Hanover Street. These are films where the bombers are the heroes, and you feel nothing for the people being incinerated below, and you're meant to feel concerned that these bombers get home.
Yeah, sorry for that.
It's just, I am sorry that I ever got sucked into this Hollywood deification of evil. And ever felt rousing sense of admiration for people who were guilty of war crimes. It's probably, but if the Second World War seems far to you, bear in mind, I was born 15 years after the war. I was born closer to the Second World War than my son Calvin was born to the Rhodesian War. The Rhodesian War ended in 1980. Calvin was born in 1999, 19 years after. The Rhodesian War seems to me so close. I mean, it was like yesterday. I can remember so much of it. And for the war in Southwest, even closer. I see the lies about South Africa and Rhodesia and Southwest Africa and the SADF and the Southern Peace and so on today. And it's the same lies they're telling about the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe and all this. And they demonize people to justify why atrocities against civilians is justifiable. So you've got people today, even on social media, saying, you know, yay, some white kids got buried under this collapsed school bridge in Transvaal. This is wonderful. You know? Less problems for the future. Yeah. More racists killed now. And the people who have been so brainwashed that they can actually rejoice in the news about children dying at a school because of bad building structure. Department of Public Works and Education Department ignoring complaints about the fault lines and the danger that this was being. Now, how can I get to that point? The same way that people, when I post something like the bombing of Dresden or the hospital ship with 12,000 refugees that got torpedoed, the Wilhelm Gustloff, by the Russians on the 30th of January 1945, with over 9,000 men, women, and children killed, and it's people saying, good, and Nazis, they deserved it. Now, what sick soul, and by the way, that comment came from a Christian, a born-again Christian, good, and Nazis, they got what was coming to them. Women and children refugees fleeing the Red Army from Riga, torpedoed in the middle of the winter into an icy sea, and there's a Christian who 70 years later can rejoice over that. That shows you the power of propaganda. And there are people all over the world who hear,
a white South African farmer was tortured to death and his wife murdered and 6-year-old child raped and murdered, and they'll say, good, racist, deserved it. The same propaganda that enabled allies to justify the incinerating of Dresden or the torpedoing of a hospital ship. Same people who today will say, how outstanding, wonderful to hear that white racist Afrikaner farmers are getting raped and murdered in South Africa. Excellent. They're getting what's coming to them. This is what they deserve. It's the same mentality. Of course not. But neither did the Dresdeners or the Passengers or the Willem Gustav deserve. But this is the mentality. And I can mention the names of Christians that we know. A Christian who worked at this mission for a while, Billy Baker, actually expressing a sense that, oh, but about the Willem Gustav. No, but they were Nazis, so it didn't matter. It's about women and children here. And he thinks a refugee camp killed in the dead of winter in icy sea with 4 torpedoes shot on the side of a hospital ship is justifiable. And a Christian, Bible-believing Christian, says that's a good thing. Why? He's brought the whole Judaism thing up. Well, the only good thing in the world is Israel and the Jews, and everyone else is bad. And if the Jews hate anyone, then we've got to hate them too. Even if they are Bible-believing Christians. There's a whole lot of people who bought that faith. This is their whole worldview. They've bought into Holocaustanity. The devil is Hitler. The gas chambers replaced the cross. Forget the martyrs, it's now of the Jews. Forget the apostles, it's now the survivors of the Holocaust camps. And forget the scriptures, it's now whatever Hollywood is telling us. And these Bible-believing Christians have bought into this fake religion. It's a completely alternative universe. But in it, you can justify the incinerating of German cities, torpedoing of hospital ships, and the raping and murdering of white African farmers. Because they're only getting what they deserve, right? But that's the mentality.
If you say that the Christians are saying you sick comments, then I think they're definitely deluded about their born-again status. I mean, they can't be born again with that kind of...
I would like to believe that, but the trouble is, I think, look, they're obviously, there's a difference between head and heart. You've got a lot of people who've got a Christian heart, but a humanist mind. Now, maybe you've got some people who are only a Christian up here and their heart is totally depraved. They're not even born again. But I'm afraid that it's possible for a truly born again Christian to be deceived. But how sad it is when you can come to the point of so distorted that I've spoken to Christians who feel nothing for the Christians persecuted by the communists. They're only concerned about what might have happened, probably fictional, but because they've seen a Hollywood film and Sophie's Choice and Schindler's List, and as far as they're concerned, the only people who've ever suffered unjustly are Jews, and all Christians are basically bad, and all Jews are God's people, and it doesn't matter if they're blaspheming, pornographer, atheist, communists, serial killers for that matter. Jews are God's people. And the Christians are evil because Christians are responsible for the Holocaust and the Inquisition and the Crusades. So any bad thing that happens to a Christian was basically deserved. Anything that happens to Jews, even if they were communist terrorists or pornographers, it's shame, they're God's people. And so you've got this lopsided, so maybe they're Christians, maybe. But boy, they're not sanctified or renewed in their minds and they're not thinking in a Christian way. That's for sure. I mean, I'm afraid this person I know, I mean, he's been here in this boardroom and some of our prayer meeting, and to look at the idiotic comments he's made about something like just, you know, the secret of Willem Gustav and having an attitude of, well, why do you care? And so what? And pretty bad. Okay, any other comments?
Just like 2 points. The current ruling party in this country, South Africa, the ANC. You recall that you will recall that in the early times when they were underground, I used to be the police force at the time, they used to go and what we call bomb the substations, and today it's just going to be powerless. And then also, you mentioned what used to happen is that these guys used to bomb substations, and the police force, all the guys used to attend. But we were always told that the second bomb coming up. And quite often when the medical personnel and all the emergency department, you know, the bomb does go off. What have I experienced?
Second bomb.
Okay, the second one, yeah.
We've got some lovely posters here as gifts for anyone who wants. If you know of a church or school that you're interested, this is the Spread of the Gospel, good posters, lots of the Reformation history. So if you can, if you know of some worthy recipients of some of these, it says on the outside what they are. So we've got some of these, and then there's notes. I should remember to put out these notes now. So I've got my notes of the bombing of cities in World War II available. So everything I gave tonight, all the statistics and quotes are there. We will, God willing, meaning Angelo will upload this as a DVD or video soon on our screen capture on Vimeo. We'll update our PowerPoint too. This PowerPoint, or I should say the original PowerPoint, which I've greatly expanded and increased and improved, already has had over 12,000 views on SlideShare alone. And the audio is quite a lot too, but I think the video will go a lot further than SlideShare. So it's important that we speak up on these things, because we can't just have our whole history organized by a bunch of pagans who hate God in Hollywood. So this is beautiful timeline of the Reformation, which also is an education itself. This is designed for homeschoolers in particular. But we've had a whole of these donated to us by this conservatory, so they're available. Any other notices? Any questions? Who'd like to close with prayer for us?
For this day that you blessed us with, thank you for this time now to learn and to hear these truths. Thank you that you have been with your people throughout history, Lord. Thank you that we can now go and share these truths with others, Lord. I pray that we wouldn't just hang on to them and know them in our minds, Lord, but that we would share it, and that we can now change our future now that we know the past, Lord. I thank you that you are in control of every situation, and even though sometimes in this world it seems so chaotic, and this country at the moment, Lord, and with all the chaos and things that are going around us, Lord, we can know that you are still in control. Thank you, Lord, that you are a just God, and that you will hold everyone accountable for their deeds on Judgment Day, Lord. And I thank you, Lord, that you are also a loving God, and that you call us to come to you and repent and to surrender to you, Lord. And I thank you that that you love your children, and that you guide us and give us strength. And I pray that you can continue to be our strength and our joy, and that every day we would serve you wholeheartedly, and that we would glorify you, and give you praise in your precious name.
Amen.